It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Bill Detweiler from Tech Republic is here. My buddy Ed Bott from the Ed Bott Report at ZDNet. And our own Lori Gill from MacBreak Weekly. And wouldn't you know it, breaking news during the show. Microsoft rejected for the TikTok purchase. NVIDIA buys ARM. We're going to talk about the U.S. DOJ, which is apparently about to file antitrust lawsuit against Google. And $36 toilet paper? Wasn't my fault. It's all coming up next on Twit. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Now, you're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether employees are working in the office or remotely. Visit LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Tech, episode 788, recorded Sunday, September 13th, 2020. Seems like a nice young man. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Learn more about how ExtraHop stops breaches 70% faster and experience a free trial for yourself at extrahop.com/twit. And by IT Pro TV. Get the best, well-rounded IT education from the experts. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use the code TWIT30 at checkout. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab with more than $500 million worth of equipment, including OEMs like NetApp. And it's virtual, so you can access it anywhere 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by Casper. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. Get $100 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twit1 and using the promo code TWIT1 at checkout. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And it's great to have Lori Gill here, who's a regular, of course, on MacBreak Weekly every Tuesday. And in real life is managing editor at iMore. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how's it going?
Wonderful. You're getting ready for a big event on Tuesday, as am I.
I know.
We'll talk about that in just a second. Also joining us, dear friends from ZDNet days, Ed Bott, who is the author of the Ed Bott Report on ZDNet. Even ZDNet isn't ZDNet anymore, but it's good to see you, Ed. We're the same.
Good to see you.
Yeah, great to see you, Ed. And from Tech Republic, now a CBS Interactive. CBS keeps changing the name. I don't know what. Ed, Bill Detweiler is here. Hi, Bill.
Hey, pleasure to be here, Leo. Viacom CBS Digital.
Oh, jeez Louise.
That's the new name.
Jeez Louise. And it's funny because it's so incestuous. So Tech Republic is ZDNet. Is it still ZDNet?
Oh, yeah. Ed and I are colleagues. Tech Republic and ZDNet are both part of the B2B group that is also part of CNET, which is also part of Viacom CBS Digital.
So Viacom was rumored to be selling a CNET. Did they actually go through with that, or was that just a rumor?
Well, that would be news to me if they had. But, yeah, that is a rumor that was out there.
Yeah, Viacom CBS to weigh options for CNET as buyers show interest. But this was back in February. And then more recently, there was a story that maybe there was a buyer, but that hasn't happened. So, yeah, Viacom's been unloading stuff is what's been happening. Not the good stuff.
They're concentrating on their core business assets.
What the hell is that? I know you can't talk. Don't, I don't want to get you in trouble with the boss. That's okay. Don't say anything.
Well, I don't know anything. Even if I could,
even if I knew,
there wouldn't be anything to share. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's one of the interesting things when you start to work for a large corporation is a lot of times people on the outside think maybe people on the inside know more than they do. I'm sure there are people that do, but not at my level.
You're right.
Not
right.
So low on the totem pole.
The latest, according to the Hollywood Reporter, because Viacom is a Hollywood enterprise, they bought CNET in 2008 for $1.8 billion. They have been selling off, quote, non-core assets after the merger with CBS. Let's see, the latest, it doesn't say, just possible sale, but it doesn't say who they're selling to. So that was
it's pretty much all because Sumner Redstone died.
Right.
And Sumner Redstone was the guy who makes us look like we're children.
We were talking about age. He was 100 or something. He was ancient.
He was pretty far along there.
Yeah. And there were some rumors that he wasn't fully compos mentis, that he was. Then maybe there was a girlfriend involved who was running things, and it got a little seamy.
Way above my grade.
Yeah, nobody. Yeah, it's not our issue either. Viacom CBS looking to sell CNET to Red Ventures, a marketing company. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. For $500 million, that's a little bit of a loss. Little bit of a loss. Actually, as long as we're in acquisition territory, another rumor. That NVIDIA might finally, and this was a speculation, be buying ARM Ventures. And this is from SoftBank, and the deal is rumored to be for $40 billion, which would be a tidy little profit for SoftBank, who bought it for $32 billion 4 years ago. $2 billion a year profit? I'll take it.
Well, they need the cash.
SoftBank made a big investment in two fine, upstanding enterprises, WeWork, which didn't work, especially in COVID, right? The work sharing place, a business. And then what was the other? Uber? There was some other big. Uber had some big losses.
Uber was their biggest one, but they had several other bad investments also. But if we want to continue with the theme of, you know, Ziff Davis, ZDNet, it was SoftBank that bought Ziff Davis.
I remember.
Back in the 90s.
I remember Eric Hippo. Hippo, the CEO, sending a voice message to all of us employees saying, in effect, you're now owned by SunSan. Everybody say hi to SunSan. He's the guy in charge of SoftBank. I remember that vividly.
It was either a 500-year plan or a 2,000-year plan for the business. I'm not even joking with that.
Seriously.
Wow.
Really long-term thinking.
Long-term thinking is fine unless you invest in WeWork and Uber. And suddenly it becomes short-term. So, so that would be interesting. Would it be a conflict of interest for NVIDIA to own ARM? They would become a chip powerhouse, wouldn't they?
It would be. There's two things that I think there. Number one, antitrust regulators would have their eyebrows raised really, really high over that one. I mean, you do have Intel as a major competitor there, but still concentrating that much power in NVIDIA, which is bigger than Intel, and then giving them ARM, that would be one thing. Second thing is, it would be really. I would really love to see Tim Cook's reaction to this, because you know he went to the to all the trouble of getting rid of doing their own silicon and everything, not having anything to do with NVIDIA for years and years and years, and now with their license, with Apple silicon being licensed from ARM, then they would be deeply involved with.
Wouldn't
NVIDIA.
That be ironic?
So,
yeah,
funny. It's very funny.
So that's one thing. It's speculated that antitrust regulators would insist on that none of the existing ARM architecture licenses, including Apple's, would be modified by the NVIDIA acquisition. I think Apple probably is scrambling. You know, it's ARM in name only. I think what Apple will do, Apple Silicon. You need ARM because you need compatibility. But I think none of the chips Apple's designed starting in 2007 with a chip for the iPhone have been really not like in the way, for instance, Qualcomm does ARM, fully ARM chips. They license the architecture. They're ARM compatible, but I suspect Apple, I don't know, but I suspect Apple's a lot of custom silicon in there that is not ARM, right?
I believe
now this is the question, Lori. I'm curious what you think. There is an Apple event. It's official Tuesday, 10 a.m. Pacific. We'll be streaming it right after iOS Today, right before you and I and Andy and Renee comment on Mac Break Weekly. And, you know, it's widely thought that Apple will announce an Apple Watch and a new iPad Air. Probably not the iPhone. That's probably going to be saved for next month. But I think there are rumors that maybe this is when Apple has said we're going to ship a computer, a Macintosh, this year with our new silicon. This might be, would you think, the event they announced that at?
You know, I go back and forth with it. I truly don't think it's going to be this Tuesday. I think it's going to happen soon. It might happen at the iPhone event that is expected to come sometime in October. I don't think this is that event. I really do think this one's going to be an iPad and an Apple Watch event and not anything else. I just don't think this is going to be their big one.
My thought is also, my wishful thinking is it is, because I can't wait to see Apple Silicon. Mm. And I'm refusing to buy anything until I see what they do with that, Mac or PC. But I think you're right. But I also don't think they'll do it in the iPhone announcement because they don't want to dilute that. So I think they have three announcements this year. They have one this month for the watch and the iPad Air. And by the way, they'll have to announce iOS 14 and probably the new Mac OS at that time. Certainly iOS and iPad OS 14 and watch OS 7 will be Tuesday. They'll announce the new iPad Air and perhaps Air Tags, Apple Tags, the new Tile competitor.
I don't think we'll see Air Tags this time around. That's an iPhone thing.
You're right.
I'm almost positive that's not coming until the iPhone event for sure. That one specifically, yeah. We might see the new AirPod Studio if that's a thing, because that seems more in line with something that could come out this soon, right away. You know, with new. iPads and things like that, but not the AirTags. I don't think we're going to see that.
To put this in terms everybody will understand, the bud will be the watch and the iPad Air. The seeds and the stems might be a few other things that trickle through the sieve. And then next month, I think iPhone, and that's pretty much going to be a big iPhone announcement. That's their bread and butter. Why dilute that? And I think maybe November... Have a Apple Silicon announcement that's dedicated to Apple Silicon. Why not?
I think I want it to be later in the year because if it's going to be this upcoming Tuesday, that means all they did was put an Apple Silicon chip in the 13-inch MacBook Pro, and I don't want that. I want a 14-inch MacBook Pro with
a new
bezel screen and everything. Yeah. So I want them to be working on a brand new Mac, and we haven't heard any rumors from the supply chain of new Mac book related things coming out. There's none of those kinds of leaks coming out. So that would mean supply chain hasn't started working on the product, which means Apple wouldn't announce something like that this soon. We'd be waiting to hear. So maybe we'd hear some rumors from the supply chain in October and then an event in November so that late November it would be ready. If they're lucky, Apple, I'm sure, wants to get it out by the holiday season. But at the same time, it's Mac. Not a lot of people buy computers for each other for Christmas. So they could delay it as late as, you know, the very end of the year, late December.
I think they'd like
to get it out at the end of the year, you know?
I think they'd like to. They need to live up to their promise. But we've seen this before. They did this with the...
But they don't need to live up to their promise because they don't live up to their promises usually. Really, they can, you know, I mean, they can hold it off. They can say, you know, we were supposed to have it at the end of 2020, but we want to make sure that this is perfect. So we're not going to release it until first quarter 2021.
You're right. They could do that. Couldn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how long did we have to wait for the Mac Pro? Right. It was like two years after they said they were going to announce it.
And I think most Apple people think better to wait and get it right than to rush something out. Speaking of rushing something out, let's take a look at this. This is the Surface Duo, which is fascinating. Ed, did you get a sample of this? Yeah.
Yeah,
and you put your bumper on too. I
actually put my own credit card down for this guy.
As did I.
Yeah.
I could top you. I spent $100 extra for 256 gigs. That's
So did I.
Oh, you did. We're gamblers. We went all in. We pushed all the chips in. We said, I don't care if it's no good. I'm putting every penny I own into this thing. How about you, Bill? Are you this isn't something you would normally review, or is it?
Oh yeah, I wrote a piece on it. But I did not put down the corporate credit card or my own credit card for one just yet. So I was going to take a little more cautious wait and see approach with it.
Let Ed and me take the arrows, right?
That's right. Let this be the Samsung, Galaxy Fold, and then see what happens for the second version with the Fold 2.
I decided not to get the Fold. It was really for me. It was I'm going to get one or the other. I do think there's something to be said for full screen devices. This is actually a kind of an interesting use case. There's the football game, and I could just sit it like this. In fact, maybe I will, while Ed talks about what he thinks of the duo. Go ahead, Ed. It's all yours. No, I'm just kidding.
What's the score, Leo?
I can't say that out loud because the commissioner, Roger Goodell, would come to my house and breathe on me. So I'm not going to do that.
So pick two numbers between 0 and 100. I posted an article today. I haven't had enough time to do a review of my own on this. I have some very preliminary opinions about it. But I did an article today where I went through, I think, 11 different reviews that other people have done.
The meta review. That's smart.
The meta review.
Yeah.
There are definitely some themes in there. I think everyone is, as am I, just blown away by the quality of the hardware build.
Beautiful.
I expected nothing less because the Surface team, that's kind of what they do, is they build beautiful hardware. They've had enough time to do this. That's something that everyone noticed. The specs on it are a bit underwhelming. It's last year's Snapdragon processor. It's only 6 gigabytes of RAM. It doesn't have 5G, but I don't care. It doesn't have wireless charging, but neither do a lot of 5G phones. It's one of those things. It's sort of last year's technology, but I think they did that so that they could really focus on tuning this brand new software to the components that are inside of it. The universal judgment on the camera is that it's not worthy of a $1,400 or $1,500 device.
Yeah.
Maybe they can fix that with software. A lot of the original reviewers who had it early, who were playing with it before they got the final, the final update that came to paying customers like us, said, boy, this thing is buggy. Things just went, they would be flying around the screen and and things would turn upside down and whatever. I haven't noticed any of that bugginess, but it does, I've noticed a few more minor issues with it. But I think the general consensus that everyone had when I read this is really visionary, and there's probably something in here that's going to survive for a long time. It's going to become the DNA of a new generation of devices, but it's going to have to go through some iteration before it gets there. And I didn't see, out of the 11 reviews that I saw, I think there were two who said it's worth buying now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's so expensive. If we're $800, then I think it would be a different, we would say, yeah, you should get it because it's cool. But at $1,400, it's hard to justify. Bill, what were your thoughts on it?
Well, I actually think I did a little tongue in cheek with the title on my piece. I said it's not the foldable phone you're looking for. And just like Ed, I thought the specs were a little underwhelming for the price tag. The productivity gains for it having not tested it out myself, I think there's a little bit of they're unproven as of yet, I think was the way I described it. But I am a huge fan of foldable devices. I mean, I've written about Samsung's and Motorola's devices. And I do believe, just like Ed said, that there is something in the DNA of the Duo or the new Z Fold 2 or any of the other foldable devices that will survive and start to become the default. I mean, for me, I'm looking for either a tablet replacement. I still don't know that I've gotten to the place where I can replace, a laptop. And still carrying a phone. Like, that's still where I'm looking. Can I get to a single device future, or is the Duo just going to be my phone and I still have a laptop or a convertible, you know, a Surface tablet or whatever it is? Or can it be the one device? And I don't know that we're there yet. So if I'm still stuck at two devices for right now, I'm still going to get a laptop to work on and then maybe just a regular phone. Or maybe a bigger foldable phone, but I don't know about the Duo yet, just yet. So I am excited. I love the two screens. I love that it says the build quality is good. I mean, that's really important, you know, with the disaster we saw the first fold. So that's very encouraging.
Yeah, I think it's less ambitious to do two screens. And by the way, these are really good LG OLED screens. They really, I mean, the red on the 49ers uniform just pops. But that's a technology that's well known and well understood and much less risky than a folding screen. And also feels like a real glass screen, which the Fold does not. So in that respect, I don't think they're facing the same kind of challenges. Yeah, go ahead, Lori.
Leo and Ed, both of you, the short time you've spent with this, does this feel like a really big, really usable, versatile phone, or does it feel like a really small tablet in terms of like how it just kind of like feels for you and works for you?
What do you think, Ed?
For me, it feels it definitely feels like a tablet. With the size and the ability to do two things side by side, which I wouldn't, even though that's technically possible with some of the larger phones, it's just something that has never worked for me. Whereas it does here, a couple of the use case scenarios that, that people in the reviews talked about and that I've seen is, for example, you can, if you're using the Outlook email client on this, you can have your message list on the left screen and your preview pane on the right screen so that you're just tap, 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 tap through the list on the left and reading things where, and you can skip over messages that you're not interested in. You can't do that on a single screen device. You can use this like a paperback book because the Kindle app in it actually flows to two screens. So, read the left-hand screen, read the right-hand screen, turn the page. And I find it easier to read to quickly scan those small screens than the big ones. And again, that's something that you can't do on a phone, but you can do on a tablet. And then there's a concept that they have of something called app groups, where you create a shortcut that basically opens two apps at once side by side.
So I'm using that, for instance, on this. I have a chess book on the left hand with the Kindle, and on the right hand I have a chess program which allows me to move the pieces. I admit $1,400 for the perfect wallet chess set is a little pricey, but it's really good. This is the best system I've ever seen for that. By the way, I also have a picture-in-picture of the Niners game, so I'll take that away because that's distracting. But I think the groups are very interesting. I've been using them a lot. You know, there's a challenge with this device to reviewers, and I think this kind of highlights some of the problems we have with tech reviews these days. Is this can't really be reviewed in the same way that you review, say, the iPhone 12 or the Galaxy Note 20, because it's not like those devices.
It's totally different.
And so one of the problems reviewers have is they come to it, I certainly did, and I didn't really know how to use it completely. And so it took me a while to get used to, I think partly there was an update you know, the minute you open it up, there was a fairly large update that fixed, I think, a lot of the problems the early reviewers had, the pre-production guys had. But I also think that some of it is it takes you a while to kind of start changing how you think about it. It's not a folding screen. It's a two-screen device. So it's so that's a very different idea from anything that we've had before. That's why I know it's not exactly a phone and it's not exactly a tablet. It's a two-screen device, which is an odd combination. And yet I think as you use it, you come up with more and more use cases. I'm also at a disadvantage because I'm not all in on Microsoft. So I don't use Outlook. And for some reason, Outlook will not let me use my mail provider, Fastmail. And so I can't really use it as my mail client. And unfortunately, nobody else has optimized their software for a two-screen device. So even some of the Microsoft apps aren't optimized for the two-screen device. So that may change as well. I mean, I think the software will improve. I do agree, Ed, that a better camera software could make this camera maybe acceptable. I mean, it's not a terrible sensor. And certainly Google has shown with the right software, you could take in a mediocre sensor and deliver pretty good photos. It's a little disappointing.
And several of the reviewers pointed out that sensor, that camera and software makes a really, really good webcam. And
it's a great webcam.
It's better than the webcam in a MacBook, for example.
Yeah. Well, that's not hard.
But the point is there that I think Microsoft probably should have positioned it that way rather than, it's also the thing is just so thin that, that they had to make a lot of, let's just call them decisions. Even if they're not really compromises, they're just decisions where you say, if I'm going to put a sensor in here that's greater than 11 megapixels, I'm going to have to make the device thicker. And if I make one side thicker, the other side has to be the same thickness. So the whole thing is doubled. Whatever thickness I add has to double there when the thing is folded and sitting there. And, you know, so there's all these engineering decisions that, that went into it, and there was a comment that Owen Williams made in his review there, which he said, when he started the review process for this, he was thinking of it one way, but the whole act of using two different apps at a time interacting with each other made him more intentional about the way he uses the phone, which I thought was a really good way of putting it. This isn't something that you just sort of pick up and glance at the way that I do with my iPhone. You pick it up, you glance at it, you put it down. This is something you pick it up, you can put it into single screen mode. Just flip it over and then you've got one screen to look at and you can sort of use it that way. But the real, what you're paying that big price for is to open it up and do something that is wide and potentially more than just something that you glance at and then close.
I'm calling. Let me turn off my audio.
Yeah.
I'm calling you via my Duo. I don't know how to do that.
That echo.
Echo. I don't know how to turn it off.
Great.
There we go.
There I am. Oh, I am sideways. Wait a minute. Now I'm upside down. That, by the way, is part of the problem with this thing. There we go. I think it's pretty good. And the nice thing is I could put this on the table like a little Smurf laptop, or as I call it, a Smurfus. And it really, I don't know why it's rotated like that. That's something that Lou MM, who works for Microsoft, said, yeah, the accelerometer's a little wonky. You have to open it wide up.
Turn on the audio from the Skype. There you go. Open it wide, and then it rotates better. And then you can tent it. But
there
then it's
go.
Tented on the table here. And I think that's great. This is a nice little big Skype call. Hey, how you doing? It's good to see you. Hey. Most Skype call ever.
Right, you know, I think that's the real, you know, sort of new thing with these dual screen devices that, you know, have hinges. Is it a phone? Is it a tablet? Is it a laptop replacement? You know, how do the companies market it to consumers who are maybe saying, what is this new thing? I mean, that was the one thing with some of the Microsoft's original messaging around this was don't call it a phone. It's not a phone. But to the average consumer, the buyer that looks at it is like, looks like a phone, makes phone calls, seems like a phone. So I think there is going to be some education there that companies marketing the devices are going to have to do if they want consumers to see it as a new way of working or, you know, using the device.
I have to say, I'm trying to think of an appropriate analogy. I feel like it's like that. It's like having a girlfriend that's a little challenging, but as you spend more time with it, you kind of grow to like it. And now I feel like I'm almost falling in love with it. Yeah. Like there's something about it. At first, it's really, by the way, the iPad had this problem too. What is this? How does this fit in to my world? Steve Jobs even very specifically said it's in between a phone and a computer. I don't know if this is what this is in between, but as you use it, the other thing, it's very hard to type because it's a little book in your hand, and typing on a little book is not easy. So
you can flip it all the way back though, right?
You can. So then it's just a strange aspect ratio phone because it's not a normal aspect ratio. It's a 3x2. Right. So it's
a 3:2 aspect ratio. The observation, I think that's a very good observation that you made there, Leo. One of the things about the original iPad was that most of the apps that were available for it were blown up iPhone apps when it first came out. And so you'd have this thing and you'd look at it and you'd go, whoa, everything's really huge.
That's ugly. You know,
it sort of seemed proportional on a phone, and iPhones at that time were pretty small. You know, they just seemed huge, but the iPad made more sense as developers started building apps specifically for that size of screen. And I think,
There is a peril here because no one ever developed Android tablet apps. So the peril is
exactly where I was going with this is that this is running is phone apps in it. And now you need to, you know, what Microsoft has done is to rejigger some of its apps to get them to behave on a larger screen, to take advantage of the larger screen instead of just being larger. And so one of the tests of a device like this is whether developers will rise to that challenge and adapt their apps to a new form factor, or whether they will just say, you know, what's the minimum flag that I can put in this code to make it, you know, install and work on a larger two screen device. And there you're going to get a sort of unsatisfying experience that way. And, you know, really one of the measures of success of this thing is going to be whether third parties say, we're going to jump in and build some stuff that takes advantage of this and helps people understand why it works. And if they do that, then there's third party hardware manufacturers that could say, well, I guess maybe we should build one of these also, since there's apps that will take advantage of this new form factor, these new capabilities.
Google did build into Android 10 and later the dual screen or folding screen support, but it's not the same kind of support that you need for this. I think one thing Microsoft did do that was quite clever is those groups that you mentioned. So I have, for instance, reading a book and taking notes side by side. And I think that that's kind of an interesting use case. And that doesn't require specialized applications. That just kind of requires the user to think of ways to use both screens simultaneously. I'm very curious. Yeah. You know, like I said, I've come to like it more and more as I use it. And I think one of the tricks is going to be to force reviewers and people to throw away their other phone and spend maybe a month acclimating to a whole different way of thinking. Just even the idea that you would hold a phone like an open little open book is weird. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just weird. And I don't think doing this really gives you a satisfying experience completely. So I don't know. I'm really curious. The fact that we've spent the last half hour talking about those shows that there is something happening. This is not a complete failure.
Yeah.
From a sort of Apple perspective, I'm excited by seeing, to me, the most interesting thing about this is the way they've manipulated two separate screens to give you a view that's important. So when you unfolded the phone and there was the football game playing on top and there was, it looked like an app tray on the bottom some other things that you can select. That is usability right there. And, you know, I'm thinking about what Apple could do in the future. That's just what I'm always thinking about. So I'm thinking, can Apple do something like this with their version of a foldable phone that will, you know, they're working on something.
Do you think Apple would do this? Or Apple will just watch Microsoft take the arrows and wait?
I think that they are currently trying to figure out how to do what Microsoft is doing, but better. They're, you know, they may not do it, but they're looking at it and they're right. figuring stuff out. And I think the part of the problem that we're seeing with foldable phones is, what's the point of a foldable phone? Like, where's the usability in this? And it kind of looks like, though it might be a little early in its early phases, the Microsoft Duo, it is answering that question. It is saying, this is what you do with a foldable phone.
What if you made a laptop sized device? I think Lenovo did that, right? There's two screens. I don't know. I want a real keyboard on a laptop. If I'm going to have
Well, laptop form factor would be too big. I would like to see this iPad mini sized.
Yeah.
That would be big enough to read a book. You know, one of the things my vision is actually pretty good for an old fart.
Yeah.
So I don't have too much trouble reading this, but I would be more comfortable if this were, you know, instead of, you know, whatever this is, you know, 5.6 inches or whatever, you know, if it were maybe an inch bigger diagonally each way, that would be interesting. But, you know, then you get into the thing about, oh, you know, they're just big phone apps.
Right.
Again, at that point.
I think this is kind of a nice, you know, it's kind of precious. It's kind of a nice size. It's like a little jewel box device of some kind. It's very elegant.
Does anybody remember the Sony VAIO-P? The little thin laptop, the micro sort of laptop that they made that was designed to fit inside a suit jacket pocket.
There have been a number of things like this where Toshiba made one, remember?
Yeah.
They were super small. They were basically a laptop. Lisa's audio. She does a great job. But you see how small this is. This reminds me of my Scion 3A, which I was deeply in love with because it had a real keyboard. It was about this size. It was like a glasses case.
So that's when I love the form factor. Yeah. I mean, I had one of these and used it for years as a sort of a test machine. The problem with it was terrible hardware. It wasn't a complete laptop replacement, but the functionality that you mentioned, Leo, of having that keyboard. I mean, we're writers and media folks, so we're working on that keyboard all the time, and that's what was really important. But you know, you would like to see. That's the one thing that has me at foldable phones and has had me with tablets. You know, I've got one of the iPad Pros, and I have both of the different cases, the covers for it, because I need the keyboard. And sometimes I want it so it folds all the way over. Sometimes I want it so it sits up. And if I don't like having a separate, I don't know if I really haven't had good luck with any of the Bluetooth little pocket size keyboards that I've used with some of the Samsungs, the Note devices. So, you know, I would like to see them figure out how to combine that folding phone with a keyboard experience that works really well.
Well, that's the Neo, isn't it? This is the Windows. Yeah. And this is delayed because Windows 10X is delayed. This is the
yeah, and I think that and
the
I
video think for the Neo, well, which is essentially a duo running Windows.
Yep.
Yeah, but the Neo, they're going to do that as just a single screen device the first time around,
and have a keyboard.
And have a keyboard. Yeah, they were there. The original plan for that was dual screen, but I think they say, "Yeah, we're going to do single screen, you know, Windows 10X devices."
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. This is way delayed. Some of this will depend on the success or failure of the Duo, frankly.
But this was also designed in a different era for right. a different workplace, and that's one of the things that's. There's been way too much tragedy, so I'm not going to call it tragic, but it'd be very sad if I had spent years of my life as an engineer working on a device like this and then discover that the world has changed around me.
That happens.
And everything that I'm doing, isn't as relevant anymore.
Now that I'm looking at this original video, this is the Duo running Windows. They've changed it, as you pointed out, Ed, in subsequent designs. But this is the original conception for the Surface Neo. It is a Duo. I don't think Windows is a good fit for this, to be honest. I think Android's a much better fit. And there's the keyboard folding out, so you get the keyboard advantage.
I think it's bigger.
Oh, it is definitely bigger. Look at the size.
It must be bigger. Yeah. And look, there's Apple's Touch Bar. I was going to say earlier.
Right.
You know, Apple. I think that if I'm an engineer at Apple, I am looking at the Touch Bar and saying, how can I take that thin strip,
right,
and how can I make that just bigger and richer? Because many Apple customers understand the Touch Bar. Many Apple developers understand the Touch Bar, and so that would be a way. Yeah, see how much bigger that is.
Yeah, but it's so much in the family, isn't it?
Well, of course,
it's really interesting.
It's a 3-to-2 form factor with the Surface hinge, and those are probably the two defining elements of the Surface family.
I'm a little disappointed that the Neo isn't going to happen. Although I think Android is better suited, frankly. Maybe as it gets bigger, it'll work better. With a full bore operating system. I just feel like something like this, or the iPad, or any tablet, doesn't want a desktop operating system. That's just too hard to use. I did like that keyboard, though. If there's one drawback to this, the Duo is trying to type on it is hard. When you fold it back, then it's just like a phone. But you kind of feel like you should be typing in this mode as a little booklet, and that's weird.
But keep in mind that Windows 10X is not, it's a desktop operating system, but it's not a desktop operating system. It is going to jettison all of that Win32 stuff.
Right.
It's going to be store apps only. It's going to be very, very locked down in terms of graphics and such. And so a lot of the things that you object to with a desktop OS include the things that make a desktop OS unstable. Well, those won't be part of it.
Right.
And all of the backward compatibility stuff, the legacy desktop apps will, the only way that they're going to run is if they are, emulated into that environment. But the apps that run in it are basically going to be things that are designed for touchscreen devices. So I don't think that's really the problem with Neo. It's just that it doesn't have an identity at this point.
Is the Duo the John the Baptist preparing us for what is to come? Okay, that's probably going too far. Let's take a little break. But you know what? Who would have thought we'd be talking about Microsoft hardware as being this giant breakthrough? I think it's very interesting, and this is also important because it's the first time Microsoft has ever been the OEM for somebody else's operating system, which is a very different role for Microsoft. Very interesting. It's great to have you, Ed Bott, dear friend, for 30 years now. Ed Bott Report, more than 30, it seems like, a long time on ZDNet. It's great to see Bill Detweiler again in charge at Tech Republic down there in Louisville. How was the – did you go to the Derby?
Well, nobody went to the Derby.
I know. It's so weird. Derby Day is such a big deal in Louisville. and to not have anybody at the Derby, it's just kind of sad. I hope next year.
Yeah, I mean, they had, you know, unfortunately, you know, won't talk about it too much. You know, there were people who were out at the Derby in a variety of protests and sort of coming out to
Louisville's had its problems, issues, of course. We've had,
but yeah, talking about people in the stands, no one went to the Derby. Yeah. So just like, you know, a lot of the sporting events we've had over the summer, no spectators.
So weird. I hope you had a piece of Derby pie, though.
Definitely. I do enjoy pecan pie with chocolate chips, is that good? Which is fantastic. Oh. Who doesn't love that?
Oh, man, that'll kill you fast, but it is a good way to go.
It will.
Mm-mm-mm. Also, Lori.
So right now I'm looking up a recipe for Derby pie because I've never heard of this before, and now I want to make
it. Well, I hadn't either. It is. It might be an acquired taste.
Really
it
yummy.
Is very sweet. But boy,
it is very good. Highly recommend it with ice cream. What's funny is it's one of those things that so Kern's Bakery actually trademarked Derby pie. So they're the only ones that can actually use that term. It's fantastic.
It is otherwise a chocolate nut pie. Yeah. If you don't want to say Derby pie, but I do note, and I wish I had done this because I would have had a milk julep and a slice of Derby pie on Kentucky Derby Day. But I do note I can order one of these. So,
you go.
Maybe I'll just get one of these Kern's Derby pies delivered. The true taste of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I just did an ad for no money. I don't even get a pie.
Yep.
Well, maybe they'll send you one now that if they hear this.
Hey, Mr. Kern. No, that's the last thing I should be eating, let me tell you. But I remember having one when we were out in Louisville. It was so good. Our show today brought to you by Extra Hop. Now, this is a nice slice of something good for your cloud. The new IT reality is remote access on a massive scale, right? Nobody's coming to work. Rapid cloud and even multi-cloud adoption. A steady increase in Internet of Things devices, all on top of a rise in cybercrime. Now, that is a stew that could be toxic. So it's more important than ever organizations can see what's going on in their environment, all the way from the cloud to the data center to the customer. In order to protect and scale your business, you need more, though, than just, you know, unified visibility. You need context so that when you're looking at that dashboard and you detect a problem, you can respond intelligently. You've got a workflow your teams can use to act fast, to collaborate easily. Breaches are a huge problem right now in business. It is a massive issue, and you do not want to be the next headline. You know, big breach at company X, all the data lost, ransomware shut them down. ExtraHop eliminates blind spots, detects threats other tools miss to keep your business secure and available. It's a SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response tool. People love it, too. Wizards of the Coast has been using it to secure and support their Amazon cloud with ExtraHop. We talked to Chief Architect and Information Security Officer Dan McDaniel. Here's the money quote. He said, quote, "There's no other company that aligns to supporting the DevOps model, the speed and the lack of friction, than ExtraHop." Ulta Beauty uses ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud as well as keep their networking and security teams closely aligned. That way, engineers have more time to focus on innovation. They're not constantly fighting fires. Senior IT engineer John Kreese says, quote, "Before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility into what was going on in the cloud. Now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud." ExtraHop started with performance monitoring, but they noted once you're monitoring the performance, look at this dashboard, too. This is so cool. Once you're monitoring that, you can also detect threats. And so it's both. It's both. Take control of your cloud security and performance with ExtraHop. Learn more about ExtraHop and how it stops breaches 70% faster. Experience a free trial just for yourself. And take a look at the dashboard because it's super cool. ExtraHop.com/twit. Real eye candy. You're going to love it. ExtraHop.com/twit, but it's eye candy that's nutritious, that's good for your network. Extra, not like Derby pie. ExtraHop.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support. We thank you, dear listeners, for supporting us by using that address. That way they know you saw it here. ExtraHop.com /TWIT. I think companies like Samsung and Microsoft are smart to jump in before Apple announces its next device or product, right? So they can get that half hour.
I just spent $1,400. I guess I can't go buy an iPhone.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, it did actually. I did choose this over the Galaxy, but I'm going to have to buy an iPhone if they come out with it. I'm saving my pennies, though, for a Apple Silicon device. Mm. I really
me too.
Have high hopes for that. And I don't want Apple just to put new guts in a MacBook 13. I really want them to come up with something that looks different, feels different. I don't want to see butterfly keys. Crossing my fingers anyway. We'll see. It's just nice to have something. The reason I think we spent so much time talking about this Duo, it's something that's different. That's just not another slab of glass. Innovation is hard in this business. Let's see. I want to kind of follow up. I guess September 15th, which is Apple's event date, is also a drop-dead date for TikTok. I was watching the football game today, and there was an ad for TikTok. That's an expensive ad. Why in heaven's name would they buy an ad if in 2 days they could be gonzo? The president said he will not extend the deadline. I have to think that both Microsoft, there's a Microsoft Walmart bid and there's an Oracle bid, apparently, maybe other companies involved. I have to think these companies are saying, maybe we don't want to buy it since China has announced there will be export restrictions on the AI, on the secret sauce that ByteDance uses to make TikTok work. Is it less valuable because of that? Is there a chance there'll be a Hail Mary and that Monday afternoon, Monday night, Microsoft or Oracle will announce, yes, we've acquired it?
Well, this one is a hard one.
While you were watching the football game, Dan Primack at Axios posted a story that Oracle has leapfrogged Microsoft as the most likely buyer of TikTok's U.S. operations, according to multiple sources. But he says the situation remains very fluid, including the possibility of no deal at all. And the most likely outcome in any of these circumstances would be two companies, one that's only in the United States and the other that is all the rest of the world, with the same name and completely different everything else's.
Including not just content, but including algorithm, right? Because they can't buy the algorithm.
Algorithms and distribution networks as well.
So, and that makes you wonder, what are you actually buying? I mean, what's the real
the
value?
The name.
Is it the customers? Is it the platform?
Customers. I mean, yeah.
Typically, you know, you get the platform, so you get that algorithm. But if you're not going to get that in the U.S., then you're just acquiring all the customers. And then you have to do all the investment you're in yourself and build the algorithm yourself or whoever gets it, it seems like a Herculean challenge.
Now, supposedly, and I didn't look too deeply into it, on Wednesday, ByteDance, they had said they were going to do this, released the TikTok algorithm. Did any of you guys look at this and see if there's anything in there or if it's just empty words? It's not the secret sauce to Coca-Cola.
They revealed some of the algorithm.
Yeah.
It's not a, they, you know, they, I think it was a PR move.
Yeah. That's what it sounds like. Really? Matt Cutts, when he was on this show some time ago, Matt was an early Googler. Of course, now he runs the United States Digital Service. He's an administrator there. But when he was at Google, he was very much involved in the algorithm for Google. He said, I don't think the TikTok algorithm's all that complicated. He said, I think we could duplicate it pretty quickly. You just look at, it's all about optimizing engagement, right? So if you just, the way that TikTok works, like YouTube, by the way, is brilliant. You get a bunch of people to give you content for nothing.
Yep.
Give us content. And then you watch what people watch. And when something catches on, you surface it more and more and more and more and more, so that when somebody first signs up, the onboarding process at YouTube or Google, you immediately get stuff that's compelling and you continue to get recommended stuff that's compelling because it's a self-reinforcing learning circle. And so more content, surface the best. More content, surface the best. It doesn't seem that hard. I think anybody could do this. Maybe that's what Oracle, maybe even Larry Ellison. Maybe that's what Oracle, I could do that.
But the real value there is not the customers and it's not the content. It's the data about the viewers.
Right.
That's, you know, I mean, that's been the value of any social network, you know, in recent times.
Well, that's clearly why Microsoft wants it, and it's clearly why Oracle wants it, right? It's the data.
Right.
Because it's a free service.
And Walmart.
Yeah, Walmart in on the Microsoft purchase, right? Because they needed
the speculation is they would partner with whichever tech firm were to win
right.
it. So that if it weren't Microsoft, then and it were Oracle, then they could, you know, they could partner with them.
Let's say I bought it. We won't call it TikTok. We'll call it LickLock. Leo's TikTok. And so the first thing I do is I say, well, I'm not getting the algorithm. Fine. In my opinion, the key to TikTok, the key to the whole operation is getting people to use it, right? And why did TikTok succeed where Periscope failed? Because creators liked it. They liked making videos in it. They liked it that they could take somebody else's audio and make a response video or a lip sync video to it. I think you do get that. It's obvious. It's on the surface. That's not a hidden thing. You get the way TikTok makes it easy for people to create stuff. That's the job one, is to get people to keep using it. That's why you keep the name. You don't call it LickLock, obviously. You keep the name. Although I like LickLock, I might create LickLock.
I'm on board with it.
You don't change the UI. The average person has no idea it's a new owner. You're going to get the data anyway, right? Because how do you get all the information you'd ever want about a user? You get them to put your app on their phone. End. Job done. End of story, right? Then you ask for a bunch of permissions real quick so nobody notices. And you're golden. Profit. So all you really need is an app that's popular. The people want to give you a lot of content. And then the algorithm, like I said, you just surface the stuff people look at. It's what Facebook does with its news feed. You know, time the engagement. The more engagement. I don't think it's that hard. I think LickLock is going to be a huge hit. Actually,
all you need is a Super Bowl ad, if you know.
Yeah.
A football ad.
Well, they had a football. I couldn't believe it. And you know, it was a compelling ad. I'm watching and going, that's funny. It really was all about what people, it was about the content. It was about the creators, which is what you want to, you know, you want to get people to download it and start watching, flicking through it like zombies. I don't think it does beg the question, why couldn't Instagram in its lip lock, sorry, TikTok, lip lock's even better than lick lock.
It's even better, yep.
Why couldn't Instagram's reels do as well? Why was it because everybody was already on TikTok?
Right.
Yeah. So I think some of that is kind of like a right place, right time sort of thing. TikTok, in part, grew in a grassroots sort of way. There's hundreds of social media things out there. Some of them catch and some of them don't. And it's just, it's like fire. Sometimes it goes out and sometimes it spreads. And while, you know, there's a lot of algorithms that and interface and features that make TikTok really great for creators and viewers, sometimes it's just a random reason why that started. And
really?
And reels coming on the heels of TikToks.
You don't think there's magic somewhere? There's some...
No.
No.
I think...
Just chance.
You have to make a good user experience and have features that people want. But there's also this like big, huge element of, gee, I hope the kids find out about it.
Serendipity.
Yeah.
You guys agree?
Sure.
Yeah.
Right place, right time.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a thing as being too early sometimes. having a good idea that just was ahead of its time. There's such a thing as being too late, you know, to the party. You know, Instagram or Pinterest, or, you know, look at, you know, Facebook catching on and GeoCities going the way. I mean, you can sort of, you know, go back through the history of tech and find things that sort of caught fire. I'll be interested with TikTok to see how it affects innovation going forward. Like if it is just fire, what incentive does a big company have to pour millions or hundreds of millions of dollars into a platform that can't succeed, or that is just going to be, you know, up, you know, just going to be usurped, or, you know, going to be outshined by, you know, three people in a garage? I mean, that's a story as old as tech itself, I guess. But it does seem like, you know, one of the other stories that we were hadn't really talked about, though, were some of the antitrust, some of the issues around sort of with the social media sites, right? Sort of saying that they had and Google saying they have too much power, too much market share, things like that. So I think, you know, what do the big companies that want to stay big that do? Do they just keep buying up the TikToks? Do they wait till something comes along? Do they then buy it up? You know, that's how we got Facebook.
I just want to announce I've just acquired for a mere $5 the domain Lip Lock Live.
I knew you were going to do that. That's so funny. I knew you were going to do that.
Now, step two.
Profit.
Profit.
No, step three is profit.
Oh, yeah. I know, but I got to get to step two somehow. I don't know what to do now. If it were that easy.
Use that TikTok algorithm.
I got a good name.
Figure that one out in the next block.
Yeah, yeah. See, this is it. This is how you make money on Twit. You have a side gig. Lip, L-I-P-L-O-K dot live. I think that's a pretty damn good domain.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So somebody's going to want to buy that up from you at some point.
Oh, there's how you make money. Sell it.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the deadline is. Apparently, there was another executive order that extended it to the 20th. But it's either Tuesday or next Sunday. Do you think it'll, and what will it cost? Because clearly it's a fire sale, right? ByteDance has to unload it, or the president's just going to, he must have a big switch in the Oval Office that he's just going to throw the switch and there's no more TikTok. I don't know how that works. I don't think he does either, but yeah. Presumably,
Jared,
there's some way.
Has the switch.
How would, by the way, come September 20th, what do you freeze the assets? You say no more. I think that's what you would do. Would you say, okay, U.S. banks, you cannot, no more money transferred to ByteDance. That TikTok would still run. Do we have a means to, I don't think we do.
We don't have any. This is yet another unprecedented moment in the last 4 years, where you look and you say, why is this happening? How is this happening? What precedents do we follow? You know, there might be a game of chicken going on here.
There's no accident, by the way, that Larry Ellison is a strong Trump donor and has an in with the president. That doesn't surprise me that Oracle might pull ahead in the negotiations.
Yeah, but you know, one reason I think you saw that ad today is the same reason that I was looking at a web page today, and the pre-roll ad was from Huawei.
Oh, wow!
It was an ad from Huawei about a doctor working in a rural community in the United States.
Wow!
Talking about how the 5G. Had freed him. He was a veterinarian. Had freed him from having to be in his office near a phone. He could go out anywhere, and he could, you know, he was about to deliver a calf or something like this. And then at the end, it was the Huawei logo and the tagline: "Connect, not divide." And I think what you're also going to be seeing, what you're seeing with TikTok there, is a little bit of, hey, look how fun we are. Look how nice we are. Why is this guy picking on us? And oh, by the way, our lawyers are going to be in federal district court at 12:01 a.m. on September 20th getting a restraining order.
Well, TikTok has continually threatened lawsuit, but they've not. Have they filed?
I don't know, but you know, you as Epic Games has shown, you know,
it's the drama, the public works. Opinion that matters.
Yeah, drama. You want drama. You want your federal court filing to be aligned with your court of public opinion filing.
Right. It's really interesting. On my sympathy, I hate to admit this because it just shows me to be a fool. My sympathies are with TikTok. I think this is such a great platform for so many people. I understand the Chinese government has influence on it and perhaps could use it to spy on people. And I understand that there have been lots of cases of TikTok censoring political speech. You can't post anything about Uyghurs or Hong Kong on it. For a while, they were censoring unattractive people. Or maybe they weren't. Maybe the algorithm was doing it for them. But my sympathies are a little bit in TikTok's court. But I just don't know. A, I don't know what the White House could do. B, I don't know what TikTok's doing. I don't know what Huawei's doing.
It's not that I have sympathies for one side or another on this, but it's more for me just what does this mean? What does this look like? And how does this work when a company like TikTok it's so big, it's so ubiquitous in the United States. And then there's a federal mandate that comes down that just says, this isn't allowed anymore. And then the rest of the world has to figure out what that means and how to follow through with that kind of ban or demand or whatever. It seems really confusing because, you know, even if Oracle were to buy TikTok and it were to become a US company, and the app on my phone that is TikTok, will that just magically turn into the app that's owned by Oracle? It seems like there's a lot that has to go into that process. Yeah. What exactly does this vague mandate really mean? You know, how much of it is enforceable versus how much of it is, just a lot of, just talk to look good. You know, this is all just so new and so different. And it's all this, you know, government that doesn't understand technology kind of stuff going on. Like, there's certainly a reason for us to be leery of this kind of ubiquity from a country that could potentially have access to a lot of our personal data. That is something for us to be concerned with. But just kind of throwing out this you just can't be in our country anymore. It doesn't work like that in technology. There's so much more involved in this that has to be thought about and figured out. And I don't know. It's not that I'm sympathizing with company. It's that I'm sympathizing with nobody's ability to understand what the heck we're supposed to do next. What companies are supposed to do next? What this means for them?
What if the game plan is for Oracle to buy it and then for TikTok? You know, the concern is that TikTok will be used as a propaganda arm of the Chinese government. What if it suddenly becomes the propaganda arm of the United States government? Is that better?
Well, in the United States, with the president that we have in place, that would be better from that perspective. Sure.
Part of this problem is, this is the 2020 problem. We are in a fog of war about everything. Even the president isn't clear about the deadline. Right. The executive order said 45 days, that would be the September 15th, but then he's later said September 20th. So again, fog of war, and I don't know if that's done intentionally or what, but it is an unsettling place to be in, especially for engineers and you know, computer folk, for which everything is either a one or a zero. We don't like, you know, one half. We don't like being in that gray zone.
And if all of this goes into place the way the government actually, like the way they hope it to go, which is there's this company that's not allowed in the United States anymore, and a U.S. company has to buy it if you want to still exist in this country.
And give a cut to the Treasury.
Yeah.
Which is another fine mess. Yeah.
Yeah. If this all goes through, then what this does is it sets a precedent for the government to go around banning a bunch of companies that exist in the U.S. or you have to sell to the U.S. if you want to, if you want this to exist anymore.
It's so a bad precedent.
There's so much going on here that it really is kind of this. It's hard to digest all this information. I really do hope that there's going to be a lawsuit. There's going to be a restraining order to like stop this from happening until there's like real clear government guidelines about what is happening here, so that we're not opening up the doors to this kind of thing happening all the time in the future.
Well, this is going to be an exciting week. That's all I can say.
and to your point, Lori, to Ed's point, to your point, Leo, too, you know, this whole situation is just indicative of how laws are so slow to be adapted to technology. I mean, you know, you've got an executive order that this is going to happen, but clearly TikTok has threatened to sue. They probably would sue. What law, what's the legal basis for actually starting to say to ban certain companies owned by? I mean, you're getting into an area that we really need Congress in the U.S. to step up to the plate and create some frameworks, laws, to help decide some of these issues, as opposed to just abdicating the responsibility and letting the executive branch and the courts work it out.
But I completely agree, Bill, but part of the problem is that there's no government right now. We don't have a robust government that understands technology. So what we're talking about is potentially lawmakers making laws about technology that they don't understand, that could stifle creativity and growth in the technology world. And so regulations can be good, but when we don't have people in authoritative places who know what to do or what this means. So I think it would be really helpful if there could be some kind of third party, unbiased tech people who just understand technology, who can get into the mouths or into the minds of the lawmakers with real understanding of this information, because otherwise you're going to have these confused lawmakers who say things like, well, Google Maps can't exist anymore because nobody's allowed to track people anymore. And that's like that. You just can't, you can't do that. But they have to be able to understand what all this technology is so that they can make really smart decisions about what should and shouldn't be regulated and how it should be regulated.
Gee, it's too bad there isn't something like the Office of Technology Assessment. Newt Gingrich killed this in 1995. Alas, this is exactly what the OTA was for: technology experts who could advise Congress to help them with objective, nonpartisan information about the scientific and technical issues we're faced with, to help them make appropriate laws.
They got rid of that in
1995.
Technology sucked in 95.
As soon as Windows 95 came out, they said, yeah, we don't need this.
Yeah. By the way, TikTok has filed a lawsuit August 24th in federal court.
They did. Okay.
They're basically saying, guys, First Amendment.
Right.
This is the people who are participating in the American citizens who are participating in this have First Amendment rights, and you can't just arbitrarily say that. So that is filed in federal court for the Central District of California. I have a feeling this is going to be that lawsuit will probably come to a head this week. I don't think it's just going to be, I don't think TikTok is just going to roll over and say, oh, well, I guess we just got to sell to somebody. So, let's just put a sign out, put a basket out on the outside and see who puts, enough $5 bills in the basket. For this, they've got money, they've got lawyers, and frankly, they have a pretty good First Amendment case.
As I remember, I think it was Lucy Coe, Judge Coe, who was going to be in charge of that case. Let me just check. Yeah. So I wonder if she will, because what would have to happen now is some sort of a stay of execution, if you will.
Or a restraining order. Temporary restraining order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She certainly, if she is the judge, she certainly understands technology. She was involved in some major technology lawsuits in the past. So,
and did a very good job.
I thought so.
On all of them. She did the, wasn't she in charge of the Oracle copyright lawsuit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I'm trying to find out who the judge is. Anyway, yeah, she's in the 10th district. So we shall see. This could be exciting. There could be something going on. Let's take a little break, come back.
That's something to talk about next week.
I hope so, besides an Apple event. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Did you get, Lori? I got a weird invitation from Apple. First of all, I've never gotten it.
Were you a little excited when you first saw
that? Yeah,
the,
I thought I was off the list. Email? Off the list. So I haven't received an invitation to an Apple event since I perhaps acted foolishly at the iPad event in 2010. There are pictures of me.
Is this a story you want to talk about?
I don't mind. They know it at Apple. In fact, the last time I was there meeting with James and the crew from iTunes, they brought it up. Said, yeah, you're the guy.
tell the story, because I haven't actually heard it.
There's video. It's the official Apple video at one point of the iPad announcement. This is in 2010. So we're outside doing a live feed of it, covering. It was very exciting. This is the announcement for the iPad. This is going to be a brand new product category. Very exciting. And I had an invitation, went in with my laptop. I'm looking behind me. There was at no point was there a sign or anything that said, you know, no recording or anything. In fact, behind me, there's the traditional row of cameras from every network and Bloomberg and everybody. You know, their guy's got this hat on. He's spinning the crank and doing the whole thing, taking the pictures. So I thought, well, you know, we're doing a live feed. Why don't I just take my laptop, turn it around, and feed some video out. Now, nobody stopped me. Nobody said anything. It may be just me. I think Steve saw me and gave me the, evil eye. But maybe not. Anyway, you see it on the video. I'm kind of looking goofy with my laptop turned around. It could have something to do with that. Could have nothing to do with that. But I never again got another invitation to an Apple event. So I was real excited. I went, there it is in my tweet. Not only invited to an Apple event, invited to the Apple briefing before the event. You got one of those too, huh?
I did.
Because then I noticed.
Very confusing.
Yeah, at the point where you're supposed to click the link for your appointment, the only link available is 10 a.m. on Tuesday.
Right.
The event.
Did you click the link? Because I did click the link, and all it did was take you to the public-facing Apple event page.
So I want to thank Apple for inviting me. Then 3 hours later, actually, the first thing I saw was the retraction, where it said, you may have received an invitation. You're not invited. But we would like you to watch the stream. And I thought, oh. But then what I did is I emailed Renee. I said, Renee, is it just me, or did somebody? I should email you too, Lori. So apparently a lot of people got this. Mm-hmm. It was a mistake in the mailing thing because everybody got the same appointment, which is the live stream. Anyway, I'm invited to watch the live stream with all of you. And that's exactly what
that's
we'll
special.
Do. 10 a.m. I'll be here with Micah Sargent. We'll be doing iOS today. We'll immediately switch over to the live event after iOS today, cover that. And then Lori and Andy and Renee and I will break it all down for you on Mac Break Weekly. So it's an Apple day on Tuesday. But so I don't know. Do you think I'm off the list? No.
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 No, you're never going off the
never
list.
Going off
no,
the
I
list.
Bet I bet there's millions of reasons why you didn't stay on that list. And it's probably not that somebody got mad at you and told
really
you
care.
Can't ever come back.
And honestly, I couldn't go because what we do is as long as they stream it publicly, I will be sitting here in this chair covering it. So I wouldn't be able to go anyway. As long as you go, Renee goes, somebody, you know, people on our team go, I don't care if I get to go. It's not. It's a fun joke. It's a running joke as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't bother me one way or the other. And as you know, and I know Ed knows this, I don't want to have relationships with any of these companies, especially with PR people. I just much prefer to be on the outside. Like you, Ed, I bought my Duo. because, you know, I don't want them calling up saying, well, where's your review? Did you like it? Why didn't you like it? Here's what you got wrong in your review. I don't want that either. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. These guys are the pros when it comes to training. In fact, it's a great story. Tim Broom, Don Puzzett, who were actually originally trainers in like a classroom situation for people who wanted to get into IT, who wanted to get the certifications. They came to an NAB panel that I was on, a few other people were on. We were talking about live streaming, and they said, wow, what if we live streamed our classes? And IT Pro TV was born. We've had a relationship with them ever since because they built beautiful studios, kind of like the old Tech TV studios, except instead of a staircase, theirs has an elevator, which I think is really cool. And they do Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, live streams. They're constantly updating. In fact, now they have more than 5,800 hours of on-demand IT training videos in every area of IT. So whether you're trying to get into IT or you're already in it and you want to keep your skills up, IT Pro TV is the place to go. Their instructors make learning entertaining. They're all experts in the field, but they're also really good presenters. They also have a lot of nice features that make it easier for you. For instance, you don't have to have a Windows server in your house. You can use their virtual labs. Try out the skills you've learned on any HTML5 browser on Mac, Linux, iOS, Windows. You could set up a server, clients, configure networks. And the thing I love about this, and I do this all the time, if you screw something else, you just close the tab. It's no harm, no foul. But it's a great way to learn. You also can get ready for your IT certification test with practice exams. And that's really important. They have practice exams covering Microsoft, CompTIA, EC Council. They do that great certified ethical hacker cert, PMI, and many more. There are great webinars featuring hot topics in the tech world. So it's not just the classes to get the cert. It's really being part of a community that loves IT and is learning all the time. They do events. They have a great podcast. I don't know if you've listened, but their podcast, TechNado, Don Puzzett does that one. Features industry guests, gives you IT news, and, of course, the best training. Get your cert, your A-plus cert, your CCNP, all the CompTIA certs, because they're the official video training partner for CompTIA. They have 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. Get that premium membership. You also get an expert guide. It'll help you set up goals and implement an IT training program to help you reach them. See, there's lots of different areas in IT. It's not easy to know. Well, do I want to do security, networking, desktop support? What do I want to do? Your coach will help you with this. Now, mark your calendars, because we're going to do an event with IT Pro TV. October is Security Month, and we're going to kick things off. Put this on your calendar, October 1st, 3 p.m. Pacific. We're going to have a lot of fun, an online panel discussion sponsored by IT Pro TV. We're going to be talking about the future. It's called Hangover. And what happens after COVID-19? What is the IT world, the tech world going to look like? And we brought in some really great people. Don will be there. He's the co-founder of IT Pro TV. Steve Gibson will be there. And our own futurist, Amy Webb, from the Future Today Institute. I'll be moderating the panel. That's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to look at what the new normal is going to be. Clearly, there are a lot of things that are going to be different in enterprise, in technology, and we're going to be talking about that. That's, again, October 1st, 3 p.m., sponsored by IT Pro TV. So invest in yourself, invest in your future with IT Pro TV. There's Don. What a great group of people. Go to itpro.tv/twit. We've got a great offer for you. 30% off for the life of your active subscription. This is for any consumer subscription. When you use the offer code TWIT30. So go to itpro.tv/twit. Use the code TWIT30. This is a really good deal. 30% off whatever subscription level you choose. Any of the consumer subscriptions, as long as you stay active. That could be forever. IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. We're really happy to be working with IT Pro TV. It's been a long time now. Great company, great people doing, I think, an important job, because especially now with the unemployment the way it is, jobs tight, difficult to find work. If you are an IT professional, you're in the catbird seat. There's always going to be a need for IT pros. ITPro.tv/twit. It looks like another thing to watch next week. The Department of Justice is apparently about to go after Google. This would be the biggest case since they went after Microsoft in the late 90s. The Department of Justice under Attorney General William Barr has been pushing for this. Some DOJ attorneys and some states' attorneys general wanted more time to develop the case. They were concerned about rushing it because they felt like they'd have a stronger case over time. The AG apparently, according to Bloomberg, said, nope, we're doing it now. I think the Journal also confirmed this. And it's expected perhaps even this week they'll announce it, along with as many as a dozen other state attorneys general, mostly from the Republican states, led by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. The states are holding off till they see the complaint before they sign in. Part of the problem is it's not clear what the Justice Department will be going after. It's an antitrust action, but is it about search? Is it about shopping? Is it, you know, is it about, it's hard to know. So watch, we will see, I would guess this week, we will see a complaint filed, certainly before the election. I think that's the deadline. As you know, the White House says Google's manipulating information to benefit the left. So that's one issue. There's also the issue of Google just being dominant. What do you guys think? Where do you think we were just talking about how government moves too slowly to regulate tech? Yet I think you could make a case. Ed, you covered the 1998 DOJ versus Microsoft case, the one that went on for 10 years. Was that a success?
No, it wasn't. I mean,
Some have made the case. Yeah. We wouldn't even have Google if Microsoft hadn't been slowed down by that case. There was an ombudsman put in place watching Microsoft's behavior to make sure it wasn't anti-competitive. Microsoft it is more successful now than they were then.
Right. And I think a lot of the, Netscape doesn't exist anymore.
True.
AOL, which bought Netscape, wound up selling the assets of Netscape to Firefox.
But that makes the argument that Microsoft was acting anti-competitively, and the DOJ stopped that because that happened before the lawsuit, right?
The sale
didn't IE kind of start to beat Netscape in 95.
96 and 97.
Okay. So the lawsuit was brought in 98.
IE didn't exist until Internet Explorer didn't exist until 1995.
Right.
And then it really became a big deal when it was first integrated into Windows 95 Service Release 2 in, the end of 95.
And they were giving it away, and Mozilla was charging for Netscape.
But what we discovered was that they had that Microsoft had discovered the correct business model for the internet, which is
free.
Give away your software.
That's a business model, okay, yeah.
and make your money elsewhere. But the idea, Netscape's business model was that we were all going to be paying $40 to $70 for
right.
a browser.
No.
Probably not sustainable. But back to the original question, was the lawsuit did force Microsoft to stop doing some extremely anti-competitive things that they were doing. But many of those had been part of an earlier antitrust action in 1994 that were tied to what they were doing with PC OEMs. You couldn't sell a PC. Microsoft would charge you more for MS-DOS because Windows didn't exist. They would charge you more for MS-DOS if you, unless you sold all of your PCs with MS-DOS on them.
Right.
And so that was the anti-competitive behavior. They were doing things like keeping APIs private.
Right.
And using them to advantage their own software and disadvantage their competitors. That was anti-competitive behavior. So, you know, some of Microsoft's behavior was mitigated with the lawsuit, but a lot of that was, you know, a lot of the good things that happened out of that were that Microsoft was so distracted
by
years and years of lawsuit that competitors were able to gather their forces and build new businesses in areas where Microsoft wasn't competing and then became afraid to compete because they didn't want an extension of their antitrust
trial. So that's a success. Microsoft's killer behavior was thwarted somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you can say that, you know, a log fell in the road and that's why the war didn't go on. Sure.
Oh, this just in. Microsoft's bid for TikTok has been rejected, officials said, leaving Oracle as the sole known remaining bidder. It says so on my watch, so it must be true.
So Dan Primack was right.
Yeah, he had the leak. So what do you think, Bill? You also covered all this.
You know, it's tough. You know, hindsight is always 20/20, I guess. You know, it'll be interesting to see what Google does. You know, Ed was just talking about, you know, keeping APIs private to advantage its own services over a competitor's services. And it makes me wonder if there's a similar, if something similar is going on with Google promoting its own answers on search, as opposed to a competitor's answers, right? You know, now Google's argued that, you know, it just wants to give customers the best answer possible. And it just so happens that, oh, hey, I own the service that's providing you the answer that I can monetize. But that's okay as long as the customer benefits. And, oh, hey, you know, we're not supposed to use words like, you know, market share anymore in our communication, or, you know, we have lots of competitors in search. But, you know, that's just not the case in reality. So, you know, I don't know. Again, to what Lori and I were kind of talking about earlier, I think this is a prime example where you have legislation that hasn't caught up with technology for exactly some of the reasons Lori mentioned. People making the legislation don't understand technology, and the systems that we have in place to enact the legislation are designed by, you know, are by design slower than the pace of innovation. So we are in this weird catch-22 situation. All you had to do was watch some of the congressional hearings with all the various tech leaders and listen to the questions and how they were being answered to realize that, you know, we are unfortunately sort of woefully behind in the rules and laws that sort of govern technology.
But who else, if not the government, who?
There are questions to be asked and demand answers of these large corporations that are possibly and potentially, you know, going against rules and regulations in place to protect, you know, progress and growth in companies. There might be anti-competitive behavior here, but somebody needs to be able to ask the right questions, or the companies are going to give the answer they want to hear. You know, just like Bill was saying with the congressional hearings, I think there was one question that was, is Facebook tracking me? Well, the answer to that can easily be no, but it's because the person didn't ask the right question to get the right answer, because there's a lot going on there that technology companies are allowed, like they're kind of like keeping their secret sauce, you know, from anybody knowing what it is. And they'll say, well, we don't want people to know our secrets, or because they'll steal them from us. But at the same time, that secret sauce is where we're starting to see them doing things they shouldn't be doing. So we need people in place, a new version of a technology oversight committee where the people are not politicians, and they have no political or their political preferences aren't part of why they're on this board. They're just really good at tech, so that when a lawmaker says, is Facebook tracking me, then that body can say, you know, the question you actually want to be asking, we get what you're saying, but there's actually a deeper question here of, how is Facebook able to provide this, you know, algorithm for a news story that it's right up their alley. You know, like there's ways that that wording can be put into place so that then the lawmakers can say, okay, now we know what these companies are doing more or less without giving away their secret sauce. So what's okay and what's not okay? Where are we like jumping the line into that anti-competitive behavior in this particular case? And where should we say, okay, that's okay, but that's not okay? And it really does come down to, Leo, you said, who then? And I think it's just got to be, we're like, as our lawmakers don't understand technology. They shouldn't be making decisions.
It wouldn't be the lawmakers because the law exists. The antitrust laws are sufficient. That's what was used to prosecute Microsoft. They are sufficient. It would be the Department of Justice bringing suit based on existing law. We're not talking about new laws having to be made.
Well, you don't think? Let's tease that one out a little bit, though. The antitrust laws that we have now were written to regulate manufacturers of steel and distributors of oil and gasoline, where the anti-competitive behavior typically, you know, it required huge investment in actual physical resources from those companies to do that. It doesn't analogize to modern technology, where, you know, scaling up can happen with silicon, you know, and doesn't require roads and trucks and bulldozers and stuff like that. The other part of that observation, you know, to go back to the whole Microsoft thing, imagine if Microsoft, that you said it was a success. The reason it was a success was because Microsoft was tied up in the courts. Let's say that that a corrupt Department of Justice decides to bring an antitrust case against Google and tie them up in the courts for years. They could effect the same change in Google's behavior. They could effect the same change in the market, even though there's no underlying behavior that needs to be modified. The reality is what changed Microsoft's behavior in the late 1990s and early 2000s was the fact of the antitrust action, not the antitrust action itself.
Well, yeah. That's how it works in chess. The threat is stronger than the execution.
Yeah, but if corruption, and remember, you had a federal judge this week, Judge Gleason in Washington, D.C., who issued, and he was a retired judge who was hired as a special master in the case involving Michael Flynn, who filed a 30-page brief basically saying that the Department of Justice is engaging in corrupt activity.
Yeah.
That is shocking. And everything that you did to introduce this segment said, you know, that the career lawyers in the antitrust division of the Department of Justice don't want to bring this lawsuit yet. They don't. I know lawyers like this. Some of them say we might never bring a lawsuit. We might spend 2 years on this and decide at the end of it there's nothing there. But if the attorney general comes in and he says, I don't care what you career prosecutors think, I want this lawsuit filed, and I want it filed well before November 3rd.
Yeah.
That is a problem.
Yeah. Okay. You guys are really, you know, basically, we should just let big tech do whatever it wants. There's no curb that's reasonable, or I mean, what do we do? That's not acceptable either, is it?
Don't you? No, it's not.
I don't think so.
You've got a seesaw. Not at all.
So what do we do?
You know, and we're at this point too, where I think that you're going to get these questions more and more often than maybe we even had in the past. I mean, look at the Fortnite and the Epic Games and Apple
Is that a mess?
Yeah. Right. So is Apple being anti-competitive by taking the 30% share of a platform they developed? It's their platform. They're the gatekeepers. Is Google anti-competitive because it's showing Google services? They have a good platform for search. I mean, so I think that, unfortunately, as we were talking about earlier with the business model in terms of Netscape versus IE, consumers, because I think the natural tendency is to say, well, let the consumer be the judge. Let us spend their money. But unfortunately, I'm sad to say that history, and maybe this makes me not as, you know, much of a capitalist as, you know, some people would say, you know, history has kind of proven that consumers sometimes make the wrong decisions, either because they don't have all the information or they gravitate to a short-term gain, or, you know, they make decisions that aren't maybe in their long-term best interests. So I think that there has to be some consensus or and around the guardrails that we put on large organizations, multinational companies, and, you know, how we do those guardrails. The only mechanism for that is our government. So unfortunately, you know, what's the old saying? We get the government we deserve, not the one we want. So it's on, you know, us to vote in people that hopefully understand these issues and that, you know, won't allow corrupt behavior to perpetrate itself.
And I want to be clear in this, that while it's, you know, tempting and certainly given my political bent and yours too, Ed, to blame Trump on this, that it actually goes much deeper than that. And it really comes down to the influence of big money in politics in this country. And it is so pervasive and so pernicious that it's hard to think that a company like Google or Microsoft or Apple will ever face the music, because they really own the coin of the realm. They have the most valuable companies in the country. If the stock market goes up, it's because they went up. And that carries a lot of weight. And not to mention all the black bags filled with cash that they dump off on legislators' tables. So here's the story. 15 minutes ago, it broke. Microsoft says its bid for TikTok was rejected by China. They announced, according to Microsoft officials and other people involved in negotiations, the Chinese company, TikTok, rejected Microsoft's offer. Boom. So Oracle is the last man standing. I should point to a New York Times article from a few days ago. TikTok bid highlights Oracle's public embrace of Trump. So I think the stars are lining up for Larry Ellison's Oracle to own TikTok. What they would do with it or whether they would be good stewards of it is not an issue, obviously, for anybody. Except maybe the people who use TikTok.
Or it could be that TikTok's play is that they're just going to reject everything because they don't want a U.S. company to buy them.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, they announced, I think they had hoped, the Chinese government announced that ByteDance, the company, this morning told the U.S. TikTok's algorithm is under no circumstances for sale. So I think that was probably the hope that would put the kibosh on the deal entirely. This is from the South China Morning Post. So
do you remember when Microsoft was going to buy Yahoo for, I don't know, I think it was $36 billion or something like that. Yeah. Just maybe 10, 12 years ago. Yeah. And that deal fell apart. Yeah. And it was, you know, of all the deals that, you know, successful and unsuccessful, I have to think that people who work at Microsoft look at that one and go, oh man, we dodged a bullet.
I think the day after it fell apart, they did that. Yeah. It was like, oh, that was a close one. Was it that much? I thought it was $21 billion. It was more than that. Wow.
You know, who knows?
Well, a billion here, a billion there, and it starts to add up. I know, either way, yeah.
Real money.
I'll take a break and talk more. I love it when news breaks during the show. Usually a Sunday afternoon, evening, nothing's happening. But we're going to have to follow the wires. The ticker is hot. It's burning up with all the deets, and we'll have them for you as it happens. Our show today brought to you by Worldwide Technology. I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for WWT because it was the last trip I took. And we flew out to St. Louis, Lisa and I, to meet the folks at Worldwide Technology. I am so glad I did. We came back unscathed. We had a meetup at a bar with all the fans. I gave people hugs. In hindsight, maybe it was a mistake, but boy, I'm glad we did because WWT is a sight to behold. They have, well, for instance, we visited the Advanced Technology Center, the ATC, which they started at more than a decade ago. It was in one building. It has grown now. I think it's in four or five buildings, rack after rack of enterprise technology, $500 million in equipment from all the big OEMs and from the little disruptors, too, key partners like NetApp and Cisco. The emerging disruptors like Equinix, they're all there. And why? Well, not just because it makes a really cool rack, and which it does, but because that's where WWT's engineers go to spin up proofs of concept, to create pilot programs. They use it as a sandbox so they can understand the technology and show their customers. That's why people who work with WWT stay with WWT. They are a trusted partner for so many big enterprises, for government, for banks, for hospitals, because that they know they can go to WWT to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right, to eliminate the risk that you know, big technology purchases can be. And a lot of that comes down to the Advanced Technology Center. On-demand and schedulable labs. By the way, you can use it, too, as a customer. It's open 24/7 remotely. It's an incubator for IT innovation. On-demand and schedulable labs like NetApp's Cloud Volumes on Tap, NetApp Storage Grid, NetApp Disaster Recovery as a Service. Hundreds of labs representing the newest advances in every area of enterprise. Flash storage, multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, cloud data management, and more. And these guys, one of the things I love about WWT is they have a kind of a corporate DNA that they are always studying processes, always looking at ways to make processes better. They are on top of it. State-of-the-art stuff. So that you know you're getting consultants' expertise that isn't resting on their laurels, but is constantly questing to find the best new technologies and to make them work in your business. WWT's engineers are some of the best people. It was so fun going there. A lot of them said, Leo, I listened to your shows. They were fans. I said, you must love this job. They said, yeah, this is the best playground ever. But it's more than just play because they can reduce a concept time to implementation from months to weeks. They can and you know, they even go so far as because they have cameras on all their distribution centers, and I see a guy there. He's building a crane. I said, "What's that?" He said, "Every distribution center has a full time on staff carpenter because we don't just ship you the pieces and say you put it together." They build it, they integrate it, they test it. Everything's working, even disparate manufacturers. It's all working. So they have to build custom special crates with special shock absorbers so they can ship this as is, ready to go. Plug and play. It's that kind of attention to detail that blows me away. I want you to check out the Advanced Technology Center because you can do your own programmatic testing using any of those $500 million worth of gear from that ecosystem, 24/7, anywhere in the world. You don't have to go to St. Louis. It's a great place for you to learn. They launched this last summer, and it's been a huge success. More than just the labs, you get access to articles, case studies, all the tools you need to keep track of what's going on in today's fast-paced world. I think WWT was an eye-opener for me. I think it's the best discovery you can make. If you're an enterprise, you need a tech partner, this is the company. To learn more and discover why organizations across all industries turn to WWT to guide them on their digital journey, visit WWT.com/twit. Create a My WWT account while you're there. You can get all those resources at the ATC. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide Technology, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. They're a great partner. We're really honored and pleased to be in partnership with them. WWT.com/twit. Thank you, Worldwide Technology. Now let's move to Amazon. Amazon says, hey, when we sold toilet paper for $36, that wasn't price gouging. Public Citizen did a study. They found the price of face masks, hand sanitizer, even flour on Amazon.com was increased by hundreds of percent, not just by third-party sellers, but Amazon itself. They published this report on Thursday. They found the price of some products deemed essential, for instance, a package of 50 disposable face masks, were sold for $4 before the pandemic, for $40 after the pandemic. 8-roll packages of Scott toilet paper, normally $7, now $36.39. This is against the law in 36 states, by the way.
I have a friend who owns a comic book shop and he sells on Amazon, and he has a bot that automatically changes the price of his comic books based on the average, or maybe it's the lowest price one. So the prices of things will increase or decrease just
on demand.
It's not Amazon doing that. So when Amazon says we didn't sell paper for toilet paper for $36, I think they're right. It's that you had to pay $36 to buy a roll of toilet paper on Amazon, but that was the seller that was setting the price of that, which is
it was an auction.
Something that Amazon should have been in, because they eventually started telling sellers they couldn't do things like that. Right. They started like putting restrictions on what they were doing, but it took a long time for them to like put it that kind of program in place. And meanwhile, there was some serious price gouging going on.
Once again, this is kind of the moral of this show. The algorithm is to blame. It's all the algorithm's fault.
It's technology.
That's very convenient, by the way, if you're Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, times 10. Mm-hmm. It's not my fault.
Right.
So I sell, I write books. One of the things I do is I write books. I've been writing books for 25 years or so, and a lot of them get sold on Amazon. And it is one of the weirdest things in the world to see a 12-year-old computer book, a book that I wrote, 12 years earlier, that is nobody in the world is interested in anymore. This is like 2007, a Windows 95 book, and seeing it on Amazon being sold, a used copy, for $1,800 because the algorithm, I've seen that. And there, I don't see it so much anymore because I think they've tweaked the algorithm so that kind of crap can't happen. But I used to see that regularly, and it was, and I talked to my publisher and talked to the Amazon rep and said, what the hell is going on here? And it was indeed algorithm. It was two sellers chasing each other up the ladder.
Yeah.
I'm bummed because my book was like, I had a book that was $600 for a while, and now it's a mere $2,683.
It's now back to normal.
Or though, why anyone would buy a book from 2002 for $2,683. Oh, wait a minute. Here's some used ones for $2. So that my recommendation, go with the $2 used, very good condition. That's a much better one. Isn't that funny? Yeah, I saw that too.
Right? It just goes to show exactly what we've been talking about the whole show, which is even within Amazon's own platform, the technology has moved so quickly that they don't have the circuit breakers in place to catch these kind of outliers, these massive sort of price jumps, or to catch market manipulation that could occur, like you were talking about, Ed, with two people just sort of trying to chase the price. Now, maybe they were doing it legitimately. Maybe they were actually trying to inflate the price. So, you see these kind of circuit breakers in other kind of platforms. We have them in the stock market. So if the price falls, things can get shut off to give people to say, oh, is it the algorithm that's caused this sort of this crash due to flash selling, or is it something else? And so I think all of these platforms are going to have to build that in to their algorithms. The other thing is to to the point about Amazon not being the seller, if they were a traditional retailer, like if they were a traditional big box store, they would be purchasing the products and then putting them on the shelves, and they would be the sort of the seller, as opposed to for most, a lot of these products, they're just a pass through.
Right.
You know, they're just the site that you
50%
come through.
50% at least.
They're a broker, right? Yeah. So it isn't even... They don't have the same incentives. They don't have the same control mechanisms to say, well, it's not us selling the product. We're just someone that's passing it through.
It's the algorithm.
Yep, it's the algorithm.
Don't blame me. How much was your book going for, Ed?
Oh, God. I literally remember one that was like $1,800.
Holy
and
cow.
I'm pretty sure nobody ever paid.
I found the Spanish translation of one of my books, Mantenimiento y Reparación del PC, for $780. That's pretty good.
Nobody is going to pay that.
Come on.
Let me just tell you from the perspective of somebody who's in the rock and roll world, like that's all you ever want in life is for your record or your book for you guys to like be super popular way after it came out.
Well, it's not that it's super popular. Because as Ed points out, I don't think anybody's going to buy it for that. I wouldn't get any money anyway. Would you, Ed?
No, absolutely not. The royalty was paid on the original sale,
right?
And the second sale doctrine or whatever, first sale doctrine says, you know, that after that first sale, they can do whatever they want with it. But, you know, basically the algorithms have taken over.
Yeah.
It's
nuts, you know, to sell them.
Skynet never happened. the algorithms took over.
A 20-year-old computer book is not worth $800, I don't think. By the way, ships all the way from Spain. So there you go.
Well, they're charging extra for shipping, you notice. Right?
Yeah. No, it's only $5.73 for shipping, although that's pretty ironic. $5.73. You paid $700 for the book.
Think about that, too. You know, Ed, you mentioned this earlier when you talked about the pace of innovation and how Silicon allows companies to sort of set these platforms up so quickly that, you know, you were talking about in relation to sort of the old days of oil and gas and manufacturing companies. But you can ramp something up so quickly like this with very little investment. So there's no incentive to, like, you don't have the limitations that you used to have, like, oh, I need a warehouse and I have to store everything as much and I have to have these retail locations and I have to, you know, there would prohibit me from putting a price of $1,800 on something, even if it's a mistake, right? You can just
Amazon
create an
says
algorithm,
they
throw
do.
The site up
yeah.
and just have it happen.
Amazon says they do, but obviously they don't do it perfectly. By the way, I just want to point out that this book has 5 stars and look at this. There's only 1 rating, but boy, is that a, it says Sandy, Sandy reviewed it, verified purchase. She said it was good.
Magnifico.
Just good.
Senor. One word.
Good. It's good. What do you bet Sandy works for Atmosphere Books in Spain? It's good. It's a good one. Get it. $700. No problem.
But this is the exact. So out of control. So the out of control algorithms are the same reason that phenomena like QAnon are out of control on Facebook. Misinformation in social media is out of control because the algorithms have outstripped the ability of the humans who created them to control them. Part of that is not understanding or not planning for the consequences of what those algorithms could do, not saying, you know, what if things went wrong here? What if two sellers started chasing each other up the ladder here? Or what if people started, you know, putting all this misinformation in private groups? But the point is, it's easy to write an algorithm. And apparently it's even easier for an algorithm to go completely out of control with unforeseen consequences.
Have any of you, this is a movie that just debuted on Netflix a couple of days ago and is getting raves. I see it's in their top 10 right now, called The Social Dilemma, which explores, according to the blurb, the dangerous human impact of social networking, with tech experts sounding the alarm on their own creations. I meant to watch it before today. I guess I'll have to watch it tonight. But people are raving about it. But at the same time, I'm kind of worried it's another one of those bash big tech things. We're trying, folks. Look, here's Mark Zuckerberg saying he hopes Facebook won't destroy society. This is an Axios HBO interview that will be published on Wednesday. He says, you know, if someone's pointing, let's see, he says, he was asked if he was at all concerned that history will remember Facebook as an accelerant of social destruction. He said, I have a little more confidence in democracy than that, and I hope my confidence isn't misplaced. What we do, and I think a lot of what the internet does overall, is give individuals more power. He says he will not remove anti-vaxxer posts, even as the pandemic rages across the world. He says, if someone's pointing out a case where a vaccine caused harm or that they're worried about it, you know, that's a difficult thing to say from my perspective that you shouldn't be allowed to express at all. So, I think Mark hopes that things are going to work out. can't knock him for that.
He seems like a nice young man.
Seems like a nice young man. it's really clear. This is a tough one. And we talk about this a lot on our network because it's something we're grappling with. It's very clear there's benefits to social media. That Twitter and Facebook have real value in a lot of ways. It's also clear that it's been weaponized. That would QAnon have the potency it has without Facebook?
Absolutely not.
It feels like that. It is a tool, that can be used intentionally or not to spread all sorts of untrue things.
Yeah, we're in this new world of what social media is, and it started out as a way for us to like say hi to our friends on the computer, and it turned into a way for us to share information, and that's where the danger has started to come in, of that we are in our bubbles and we believe our certain beliefs and we have our friends who believe those same things. That's the way our world works. And then we have these algorithms that are built around us that show us information that confirms our bias. And then there's articles that are not vetted by the same kind of journalistic integrity that existed, prior to the computer. So that information is being shared in my bubble with my friends. We all believe it. And we all move on, solidifying our beliefs,
right,
growing those beliefs, creating new groups around those beliefs.
All of that's and a natural media, human tendency. Mm-hmm. It's just it works better with social media.
Because it allows larger groups of people to befriend each other
and
get reinforcements of their beliefs.
Yeah.
Leo, you're right. It's good. I learned a lot about protests that were going on that I would not have known if it weren't for Twitter.
Right.
So it's good. But
it's
you
good
can't,
and bad.
You can't be the arbiter of what's allowed to be good and what's allowed to be bad on a social platform, because then you are the one who is politically making voices heard and not heard.
Then you're Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah.
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 I can see why he wants to abrogate all responsibility, because you're right. He doesn't want to be the guy who says that's true. That's not true. That's true. That's not true.
And yet, but I think that's, that's the one area that I do slightly disagree with, sort of the blanket abrogation, as you called it, Leo, of responsibility that, social media platforms and anyone who's run, forums and internet sites, we've talked about 203 issues before. I mean, but in the past, maybe there were more consequences that people felt as a result of bad activities. But what we've seen now is a lot of these activities that have negative outcomes, either unintended or not, the perpetrators face no consequences for those. So, and as Lori was talking about, those bad views are amplified to many, many, many more people. And, they're unfortunately, you have people that just sort of live in these echo chambers and never get outside their bubble, never hear other information. And it gets, you were talking about YouTube. being that self-fulfilling prophecy, an idea gets popular and the popular idea gets promoted and that's all you see. And it's really hard to break in with a new idea. So it's not an easy, you know, it's not an easy question to answer. I think we're still trying to figure that out. But I wouldn't.
Sure. Yeah.
But I wouldn't sort of I do think that there needs to be mechanisms in place to control some of the consequences that happen when you have, I mean, when you have blatant sort of disinformation. I mean, there are checks on freedom of speech. You know, freedom of speech is not an absolute right. You can't go into a theater and yell fire. You can't do hate speech. So we've accepted that there are limitations. And I think it's always sort of up to society at any one time to determine what those limitations are.
But there is a burden. Is there not a responsibility in the social networks for Twitter and Facebook to do to do admittedly hard to do, maybe not going to be perfect, but to try to do the right thing?
And that's where I think right now a lot of the issue comes into play is that Zuckerberg is a perfect example of somebody who says, I just threw the party. I didn't make people fight each other at my party.
Right.
And so it's not my fault that they fought each other at my party. But then there's fights at my party every single time. And I just keep letting it happen. And a couple of people got killed at my party, but I just threw the party. It's not my fault they killed each other. Then you're like, okay, well, when are you going to take responsibility for the things that are happening at your party? You threw this party and it's your responsibility to protect them. So what are you going to do about it? Yes, it's not you didn't spread the misinformation, but you are the arbiter of that, of the spreading of that information.
It's my sense that Twitter is doing a better job than Facebook at this point. Is that, do you guys agree on that?
Well,
Twitter's kind of a hot mess.
They're trying. Okay.
No, they've gotten a lot better.
I feel like they've gotten a lot better.
So here's the problem. The way that the way that social media services are set up is they reward engagement.
Right. The algorithm.
Yeah. We're back to the algorithm. And the engagement is what brings them the economic benefit. So if your criteria for success in battling misinformation is removing it from your platform after it's already there, you have lost from the beginning, because bad speech will always crowd out good speech, because that's just the way it works. They have more incentive to do that. The fact is, the systems have to be built in such a way that they don't allow misinformation to spread in the first place. If you're constantly reacting, then the lies are going to spread faster. But by the time you start blocking things, they've already reached critical mass. It's like basically saying, you know, we've got a nuclear reactor here, and I think we can pull the fuel rods out to about here, but we're going to stop right there because, you know, and you know, once things get out of control, you've things blow up.
Yeah. Things blow up. That's the that's the bottom line. That's welcome to 2020, where things blow up.
By the way, speaking of breaking news, Leo.
Yeah.
Nvidia just announced it has agreed to buy SoftBank's chip division Arm Limited for $40 billion.
$40 billion, that was the number. People laughed at me when I said it's going to be a lot. I actually said I think $60 billion, which really would have been a lot, but that's a pretty good premium. $40 billion. Now, subject, as they always say, to regulatory approval. Although I have to say, unless you're Google or Apple, I don't think you have to worry about any trust regulations these days. I think, yeah, go ahead. That's fine. You know, it's by Sprint. That's okay. Nobody could. It's not. It's fine. Good. Well, there you go. Another breaking story. That's two today. Sunday's the day, man. This is it. We had a fun week, actually, all week long. We're going to have a great week next week. I think this is a good time to be covering tech. Let's take a look at some of the things that happened this week on Twit. I confess, I wear pants that look like dress pants.
Yeah.
But they're actually sweatpants.
No, that's not giving up.
We went out to dinner, and for the first time, I want to say, during the pandemic, I wore a dress shirt, but I wore, like, gym shorts.
Yeah, perfect.
With it. Perfect. My wife was like, really?
Perfect.
Previously on Twit, all about Android.
Android 11 is official today, just like that.
My top three favorite features in order is the power menu, media notification, and I'm excited by the idea of the conversations notification.
Hands-on wellness.
There's a company out there that is giving folks an option to be able to do rehab for stroke care at home in the comfort of their home. This is the NeoFX Smart Glove.
This Week in Google.
We could have a lot of really interesting words, like my computer glob, for lack of a better word. I walk into a restaurant, the computer glob can say to the restaurant, hey, Stacy's allergic to bell peppers, and she hates the following music.
I mean, it really is the phone, because without connectivity of any kind, it's useless. It's a blob. It's literally a paperweight. It's
blob, not a blob.
Okay,
blob.
So you your global location-oriented biome.
Yeah, so you can breathe.
I think this is it. We've solved it.
Twit.
We've solved the future of computing. The future.
Tell your friends.
That's funny, because in that little clip where he's talking about my three favorite features of Android 11, that's really all you need to say right there. That's it. Android 11, that's it. There's, you know, some a couple of little features. It's like, there's not even a news story there. Yeah, that's it. That's what you got. Okay, fine. It's actually on our rundown, and I was thinking about bringing it up, and then I thought, but there's not, what are you going to say? We are really, literally at peak. That's why I think the Duo got attention, at least my attention, is we're kind of at peak phone. By the way, the Duo's Android 10. Oh, I don't get those three features? Shucks. Oh, shucks. Now, the laughter will be coming out of the other side of your mouth, Lori Gill, on Tuesday when iOS 14 comes out. Actually, there are some nice features on 14.
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
Yeah. That's going to happen Tuesday, right? iPad OS and iOS
almost
14.
Definitely. If they're going to drop a new Apple Watch, they're going to have to drop WatchOS 7, and that means they're going to have to drop iOS 14.
Big Sur, will that wait till new MacBooks?
I think it's going to wait.
Okay.
I think it's going to wait because I don't think it's fully baked. I think they're just not ready yet, and that's not unknown. Apple does this all the time. They've waited up to a whole month after the other operating systems dropped. The public beta of macOS came really late in the game. And I think they're going to make it wait a little bit longer and probably till the new Mac silicon comes out, unless for some reason the Mac silicon is not going to be for way a long time. I think we're going to see it in mid-October.
Yeah, I think you're right. I actually hope it holds off because I decided today when Big Sur comes out, to wipe my iMac drive and start fresh.
And it's always a nice feeling.
Yeah. And I thought this is an opportunity to rethink everything I'm doing with my Mac setup. For instance, I might shift from Homebrew to Mac ports, things like that. This is the time that you would think about that. And do I really need to install those 15 apps that I had never used for 5 years? So I think I might even write a blog post on the next build, given Big Sur is coming out. This might be the time to do it. Our show today, in order for that to happen, I need a good night's sleep. I've just got to tell you. There's no incentive to write a blog post when you're sleepy. Thank God I have a Casper. Casper is the original online retailer of premium mattresses at a fraction of the cost because they eliminate the middleman. They use obsessive engineering to design mattresses that are cleverly mimicking human curves. They give you both, it's kind of amazing, flex and support. Look, you spend a third of your life on your mattress, maybe more in my case. You ought to be comfortable. The original Casper combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep service with just the right amount of both sink and bounce. And really important with all the Casper mattresses, breathable design. You want to sleep cool. Casper regulates your body temperature throughout the night. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is fast becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Now, this is the hybrid that I'm opening up here and falling asleep on. I think the cat will join me in a minute. The hybrid combines the pressure relief of the award-winning foam original Casper mattress with durable yet gentle springs, which is nice because it gives me a firm edge. I don't fall out of bed anymore. I It gives me a little support as I'm hitting the edge. There's the Wave, which features a patent-pending premium support system to mirror the shape of your body. And the Essential, which is a streamlined design at a price that won't keep you up at night, perfect for guest rooms or kids off going off to college. The thing I love about Casper is you not only save money, but you have 100 nights to try it. 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. If any time in the first 100 nights you say, it's not for me, they'll come and get it and refund you every penny. You do not have to put it back in that box. It does come in a surprisingly compact box, but I don't know how they do that. So fortunately, I don't have to do it. Free shipping, painless returns in the U.S., and Canada. Get a Casper mattress today. You're going to save $100 towards select mattresses. Wow, look at that. Now it's 50,000 reviews. 50,000 five-star reviews. Wow. You can save $100 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twit1. That's casper.com/twit1. And the offer code for $100 off is twit1 at checkout. Twit and the number one. Terms and conditions apply, of course. $100 off select mattresses by going to casper.com/twit1. The offer code is twit1. Thank you so much, Casper, for giving me a good night's sleep. And I know many thousands of our viewers who have Casper mattresses feel the same. Good on you. And if you don't yet have one, or you've got a, you know, an extra bed you need to fix up, casper.com/twit1. Don't forget the offer code twit1 and let them know you saw it here. Thank you, Casper. We should do some lighthearted, fun stories. It's been such a serious show. I thought this was good. Sasha Segan does this every year in PC Magazine. Give him a lot of credit because this is the thing PC Magazine used to do so well. They would do 100 printers, right? They would do the roundup of all the latest laptops. Only a big publication, and there is no magazine in PC Magazine. But only a big publication could go out and go to 26 cities during a pandemic and test the mobile networks. But the thing that, you know, fastest mobile networks of 2020, they've done this every year. But the thing that was most interesting to me is, 5G, not so much. Not right. So much.
There's this big push for companies, for phone makers to make phones with 5G, but the 5G infrastructure is just not really quite there yet. And it's surprising to me that so the new iPhone, for example, that's coming out later this, you know, in the next couple of months, there's going to be a lot of pushback from the public, the tech public especially, if those phones don't support 5G. But what's the point of supporting 5G right
exactly.
now?
Exactly. That was one of the knocks on the Duo is it doesn't have 5G. Right. To me, that's great. I don't care. I would not benefit from it. So here's the money paragraph here. So wait, writes Sasha, 5G isn't as fast as 4G. We admit it. We bought into the 5G hype. Carriers, phone makers, and chip makers alike have all been selling 5G as faster and more powerful than 4G with lower latency. So I was shocked, I tells you, to see that our AT&T 5G results especially were slower than 4G on the same network. This is a crisis for marketing, not for performance, because all three U.S. carriers, yes, there's only three now, showed significantly higher download speeds and better broadband reliability than they did last year. It's just that these gains, especially in AT&T, are largely because of improvements in 4G, not 5G. The good news is, with few exceptions, you don't need to rush out and buy a 5G phone. Now, when you get 5G, especially if you get millimeter wave, the high band 5G, it can be really fast. They were able to test Verizon, probably in New York City. Verizon has millimeter wave in certain areas as fast as 2 gigabits down, which is awesome, and 100 megabits up. But that's not what you're going to get most of the time.
And you'll have to pay extra if you want the phone that has the millimeter wave sometimes.
And you'll have
too,
to stand in exactly the right spot.
Yeah.
And not
with no
move.
Trees in your way.
Because at those higher frequencies, it doesn't travel very far and it bounces off anything, including a heavy mist. So 4G is going to be around for some time. 5G availability, according to PC Magazine, was 4% of U.S. customers. Just not really that good. That's in Verizon. T-Mobile, which is the low band, 600 megahertz, half of T-Mobile's customers can get it, but you won't notice the difference because it's not any faster. And in fact, 38% of AT&T customers can get it but don't want it because it's actually slower. So it's a really a mixed bag. Is it going to get better? Is this just, you know, is this what it was like when LTE came out? Bill, you think it's going to get better?
Yeah, I think it'll get better. I mean, I wish I could, because the promise is there of a, you know, a really fast wireless connection that can rival what we get out of, you know, fiber or a wired connection. So the benefits far outweigh, you know, the initial sort of starts and stops, especially, you know, at Tech Republic, we look a lot at enterprise, and in the B2B space, there's a lot of interest around 5G. And like you were talking about, high bandwidth, ultra low latency, you really need 5G to do some of the things.
But that's going to be a dedicated, that's going to be, I have a dedicated receiver and right across the way is the dedicated 5G millimeter wave tower, right? I mean, it's going to be that level of, and it's going to be expensive.
Well, you definitely need to build out an infrastructure like you were talking about, especially, you know, if you're dealing with millimeter wave compared to like sub six. I mean, you've got, considerations for the density of the buildings around you, about, you know, how you're going to be able to propagate this out into a rural area, because that's one of the areas that it could have a lot of benefit for. So
sure.
I don't think the hype around 5G is necessarily wrong, but I think it's going to take a little longer to play out than people may, you know, people promoting it now may expect, right? So for most people, they're probably not going to see benefits. You know, I can't get it here. I would love to have 5G so that I could, you know, use that as a hotspot, you know, compared to the 400 megabit broadband that I can get. I mean, if I could get 2 gigabits
as
opposed to 400, you know, when you're sharing a connection between multiple people in a house and I'm doing a video conference and trying to watch a Twitch stream and trying to do, you know, so it has its benefits, but I think it is going to take a little longer. Now, I'm interested to see, you know, the manufacturers, you know, Samsung's putting 5G in all their flagship devices. So, you know, how long are people going to keep these devices, or how much, what's the premium they're going to have for future proofing? Like, are consumers going to want to pony up an extra couple $100 to say, oh, I'm going to keep this device for 3 or 4 years, 2 or 3 years. And so, yeah, I'll go ahead and get it with, I'm glad it has 5G in it, so that when it does get here, I don't have to buy a new $1,400 phone.
So that's the real question in my mind. Is this just like any other new technology, like the 4G rollout, where it just takes time, or was 5G overhyped? What do you think, Edbot?
Well, is it so? In other words, the question is this like what was it? Was it 3D audio? What was it? Or the
3D or 3D movies?
3D TV?
3D TV?
Or 3D TV? That's what. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
Which was, I remember going to, you know, CES for a couple of years in a row. There were 3D, 3D,
it was
3D
everywhere.
TV.
Yeah.
And anybody who bought one of those, boy, they're really living the.
I got a bunch really of 3D glasses I could sell anybody who wants them. You know, they're coated with dust because they were never, literally never used. They came with my Samsung TV and literally never used.
Yeah. So, I mean, so two things. One is we're Sprint customers here, so now we're T-Mobile customers. And I just got an email a couple of weeks ago from T-Mobile saying, you know, congratulations, Santa Fe has 5G now. Well, you know,
except for you Sprint customers.
I've driven. No, they said for us Sprint customers too. Same network.
I thought they were saying they were having trouble integrating the towers.
They said that I should be able to do it. So I drove all over town holding my phone up. Well, I was in the car.
Yeah, that's okay.
Someone else.
Your wife was driving. And yes, of course.
Holding the phone up and I never saw that 5G logo. I think the thing is, I think the real key here is going to be backwards compatibility, because these networks are going to be a mix of 4G and 5G for years. And so just as the PC Mag guys discovered, your phone is going to be set up to connect to whichever network is best.
Right.
And for a long, long, long time, that's going to be 4G. What's going to happen, though, is what's happened over the last 10 years, which is my broadband, or my mobile speeds have gotten steadily, not dramatic, not blind. There's no big step leap at any given time, but each year it's a little bit faster than it was last year.
Yeah.
And that's just because of the infrastructure just slowly being, all the old stuff being replaced with new stuff. And as it, you know, as it just rolls out and gets bigger and bigger. But, you know, the idea that one day you're going to get that 5G phone and, man, you're going to be walking around and you're going to say, you know, I want to watch that movie and I want to download it in 7 seconds. You know, I think it's going to be a, maybe never before we see that as a widespread phenomenon.
I will never forget going into the T-Mobile store when they were still selling the late lamented OnePlus McLaren 5G phone and asking, I said, oh, this is great. Is 5G here in Petaluma? No. Oh, well, could I get 5G in San Francisco? No. I said, well, where can I get 5G? He said, Ukiah, which, as you know, because you live in Northern California, Lori Gill, is the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. It's like the high desert.
But I guess I could get 5G there. Can you get it in Sacramento, Lori?
I don't think so. I haven't checked because I don't have a device that has 5G. So I don't know for sure.
The new iPhone,
I haven't heard that.
Comes with 5G, right? That's the rumor, right?
That's the rumor. Yeah.
Whether you want it or not.
I know. Well, so in my opinion, 5G is going to come. It's not going to be a 3D TV thing. And it's because the demand. Like, we demand more, you know, download speeds as users and as consumers. Gaming is becoming a streaming thing. We're downloading more things onto our devices. We're downloading things to our home entertainment systems. The demand is there. So 5G will come. And just like Ed was saying, we're going to have this sort of like in between phase where there's going to be, your phone is going to connect to whatever the best,
right,
the best spot is for a while. But just like it was with 3G to 4G and 4G to LTE, you know, at first you're always going to be on the lower band, and then at some point it's just going to be the switch is going to be flipped, and you won't have even noticed that it flipped. You're just now using the higher speeds, and you maybe won't even notice that you got a slightly faster download of a movie or something. It's just there, but it's happening. It's just that the hype makes it seem like it's a really big deal. And frankly, it's really just something they should have been doing in the background to just tinker with, you know, the world to make the internet speeds faster on mobile. And then we just don't notice it and suddenly have faster phones.
It would be kind of, I mean, I don't know. It's better to market, I guess, a new product and get people to buy it. But
yeah,
it is kind of a nice feeling when you just go, wow, this got fast all of a sudden.
Then you think, well, my phone must be really
good. This is awesome.
Good.
Yeah. This is great news.
Yeah. I don't know the secrets behind it.
I just spent a lot of money to eliminate Wi-Fi in my house and put Ethernet everywhere. I had a guy in the attic in the basement crawling around, running it up through the walls. And we still have Wi-Fi. But he said, you know, you can get faster internet. I said, what do you mean? I got a business class Comcast. He said, oh, don't get business class. You can get a gigabit on the consumer. I said, when did that happen? And he was right. In fact, it cost me $50 less. But I had to sign up for a triple play bundle. Apparently, I've had phone service from Comcast for years. I didn't even know it.
Oh, wow.
Because it's cheaper. As soon as you take off the phone.
Same here.
Well, then what the hell is it? I don't understand this. I don't get it. I don't understand it. Well, I do understand it because it's for a 1 or 2 year term. And then all of a sudden you're not paying attention. And when you turn your back, they double your bill. Suddenly it goes.
Leo, just this is how nuts it is. But I had the same phenomenon. And I went from the Comcast double play to the triple play to bring my bill down by $50.
Yeah.
And then the following year when my contract expired, I went from the triple play to the double play to bring my bill down by $50. You just switch back and forth
every
year.
I can't wait to the day when I say, I don't need, I just want internet. Can you just give me internet?
That'll be $1,000.
Right?
Yeah.
It's happening. 37%, according to Kagan, which is a part of S&P Global Market Intelligence, 30% of broad, 37% of broadband households in the U.S. are now cord cutters. They get only internet. That's up from 12.5% 5 years ago. And I guess it's going to get higher and higher. In fact, it became I figured, okay, I'll do this one-year deal. I'll keep the TV because I don't want upset in the house. But next year, I swear to God, I'm going to get everything, but it's just going to be all over the top. Right? That's the future of television, is over sure. the internet, not over the cable. Or yeah. through the air, even. I would think 37%.
I've never paid for cable as an adult. I've never paid for cable.
Have you paid for cable as a child?
Oh, my parents probably had it, but not me. In my own life as an adult, have I ever paid for cable?
Wow!
Don't need it.
You don't need it.
There's all kinds of ways to watch movies and TV shows. And
well, I used to say now, that's because you're young, but now that I know you're not young, I just think it's just because you're smart. But my kids, I mean, they don't have a landline. They don't have cable. They don't have any of that stuff, right? It's YouTube and cell phones. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. I think we could probably wrap things up here. I'm just looking to see. Are there any big stories that I didn't cover that you guys were all hot and
is
bothered?
Is there any breaking news that's happening again?
Yes, Fortnite is having a concert series. They want to become part of... for a tour stop for artists. Is Sick Burn going to play Fortnite? They're actually, that's Lori's punk rock band.
My nephew would love that.
Wouldn't that be hysterical? They actually are building a stage, a theater, concert stage and theater space. So that
physical,
that bands will come there and perform, and then it'll be part of Fortnite in some, I guess I've only played Fortnite, the version where you're killing people, but apparently Fortnite has a virtual stage and Diplo has performed there. Steve Aoki, Deadmau5. It's popular. The Tenet trailer was aired there. Epic's 1980 Fortnite commercial was aired there. They even had a discussion about race in America. Millions of people literally have been in the virtual Fortnite theater. So they're building a state-of-the-art studio space in L.A. with a massive LED wall and floor and robo-cams that can be operated remotely.
Are they going to make 3D renders of the musicians so that they
no,
that,
it's like, a screen.
Their avatar appears?
As far as I can tell, so it's just like a video. Yeah, okay. So here's an example. Here are Fortnite people wearing their Fortnite costumes watching a video screen. It's like a drive-in.
Right. Yeah. 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 But what I'm wondering is why is Fortnite building a special stage just for that?
Know.
Because
I don't know.
If you can just use, if it's a flat screen, then, you know, it could be any stage anywhere.
Well,
they just
but
need
yeah, but they
the
want
video feed.
They want
it.
Artists to come to their special Fortnite LA studio. It is in LA, yeah. Right?
Of so. Course. Does that mean that humans will be able to go in real life to these performances and watch it while they're using Fortnite on their, well, not their iPhone, because that's not going to happen anymore.
We're going to have to leave that one for our October 1st panel on what happens after COVID, because you're right. I wonder if people will even bother going to concerts. John, who is a fan of a jam band called Umphrey's McGee, I'm sure you all know it, has been now to two virtual concerts. They had drive-ins, and people would come in their car, and you're supposed to dance around in your car, and then they're on the stage where the screen would be. They do it in parking lots and drive-ins and stuff, and then you watched it via stream, right? So I don't know. Maybe that's the future. I don't know. The future is weird. We know that
much. The Fortnite thing still just reminds me too much of like Second Life.
It's a lot like that.
I don't know if I can do the virtual sort of concert with avatars in it. I don't know. Maybe I'm just too old, out of touch, but that seems like a throwback to something that didn't really work that well 10 years ago.
What a world. What a world. But that's what we're here to cover. Bill, it's been great to have you on. Bill Detweiler, he's the editor-in-chief of the Tech Republic, techrepublic.com. He's Bill Detweiler on the Twitter. It's great to have you. Anything coming up you want to plug? What a great shot, too. This is a beautiful camera you're using.
Yeah, I'll plug the great shot and being able to do this from. Thank you. Great time as always, Leo. Always a great conversation.
Thank you. Yeah. It's nice to have smart people talking about these things so that I, as a dumb person, can understand it better. I really appreciate it. Ed Bott has been educating me for 30 years, and it's always great to see you. The Ed Bott Report on ZDNet, at Ed Bott on Twitter. Anything you want to plug coming up?
I got the fourth edition of Windows 10 Inside Out coming out in a couple months. We're about to send it off to the printer. Really, I think we really nailed it this time. It's just...
Do you have 2004? Really is it covering 2004?
This is actually covering 20H2 even.
Oh, so, wow. The newest version. Yeah. When is that? That should be now, right?
It's available now. If you go and
join the for reals.
It's in the release preview ring of Insider, or you can go download from the Insider site. You can go download the ISO and just upgrade to it. And it's one of those, it's the second half release. So it's just all the bits are already in 2004. This one just turns on a couple extra features in there. So this one is the safe upgrade.
Thank God.
You know, the spring, the March upgrade, March, April upgrade is a little, stay back.
Well, that's the irony of it. It's not even half of the users are at 2004 and already the next one is ready. So it's kind of weird. Kind of weird.
Yeah. So, but this is the one you want to upgrade to. Anyway, the book will be on shelves probably in ebooks end of November. Nice. So look for it.
Is there a website you're on, or just go to Amazon and get a copy?
Just go to Amazon and get a copy. Cool. Yeah.
And maybe if with any luck, Wilco will be performing in a Fortnite theater near you.
I would love it.
People commenting on your great Wilco poster.
I noticed that right away too.
Wilco in New Mexico, I guess, is what that is.
That is. They played at the Santa Fe Opera a few years ago, and it's one of my favorite posters.
It's awesome. Yeah. Thank you, Ed. Great to see you again, Lori Gill. I never see enough of you. We see you every Tuesday, of course, on Mac Break Weekly. We'll be back right after the Apple event to talk about it. And of course, you can read Lori and read her work at imore.com. She's managing editor there. It's great to see you. You excited? You're ready for a big Tuesday?
I'm so excited. I'm so ready. I'm over ready.
I feel like it'll be a little disappointing if it's just a watch and an iPad.
All I'm expecting.
Really?
Lower your expectations.
Okay.
I think that's all I'm going to... I'm not expecting any more than that. I think it's going to be new Apple Watch Series 6, new iPad Air 4, and also low-cost Apple Watch that will replace the Series 3 and new iPad, standard iPad, but only with just a little spec pump. So that's my prediction. Let's talk on Tuesday.
Well, I'll be putting up my videos at liplock.live. Actually, Scooter X in our chat room has the name for the new TikTok. It's going to be Tiktorical.
Good one.
I like it, Scooter. I want to, by the way, I also want to thank all of you for foregoing the Princess Bride reunion to be here today. It's inconceivable that you missed that. But, hey, sometimes there's a collision, you know? News happens. And
Leo. Yes.
Although,
as you wish.
I've forgotten about it until I saw Trumperdink in the Twitter trending up. And I guess that's the hashtag Trumperdink.
That's a good one.
For the Princess Bride event.
Thanks, Leo.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Lori.
Yeah, thanks, Leo.
Have a great night. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon right after the Tech Guy Show. That's about 2:30 Pacific time, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. If you want to watch us do it live, it's kind of the behind-the-scenes video, including all the chit-chat before and after. Just go to twit.tv/live. That's a live audio and video streams, actually, from a variety of sources there. And I should mention... We do this every year, ever since Apple took us down on YouTube. We do not do our live stream coverage of Apple events on YouTube Live. We do everything we do is on YouTube Live, except for that, because Apple is, grouchy about that. So the best way, if you want to follow our live event coverage Tuesday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, is just to go to twit.tv/live. And you'll find all the various streams. We just put reruns up on YouTube Live during that time. If you're not watching live, of course, that's the easiest thing to do for anything we do. You can catch everything we do on demand. That's kind of what it is. It's a podcast. Go to the website, twit.tv, or go to YouTube. There's a YouTube channel for This Week in Tech. You can also ask your Amazon Echo or your Google Assistant to play Twit Live. Sometimes you'd have to say, like, on TuneIn, there's various, it changes all the time. Or play, I found that if you say, play the latest This Week in Tech podcast, that works pretty well. And you can listen to the latest episode. If you are an Amazon Echo user, don't forget we have a flash briefing item. So I don't know if you use your flash briefing on Echo. I use it every morning. I get up and say, what's the news? And it will give me my flash briefing. You have a variety of news sources. Twit is one of them. So we always make little clips for the flash briefing for every day of the week. So make sure if you are a flash briefing user, I think there's about 40,000 people who listen to us every week on Echo's flash briefing. If you are, add Twit so you'll get a little clip from each of our shows in your flash briefing. No machine reading. It's a real audio clip. You can also, and I think this is a great thing to do. I like it when you do it. Find your favorite podcast application and subscribe. We have links to the RSS feed, to YouTube, to Apple, to Google, all the places you can subscribe to watch us on our website, twit.tv/subscribe. Subscribing is the best thing to do because then you get it the minute it's available. You don't have to think about it anymore. That's it for this week. Have a wonderful evening, and I will see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing. Bye.